If only there was a way to engineer the human eyeball to watch 10 different screens at once. Keep your eyes and ears on every game with Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Bit of an extended version of Sportsnet tonight. Yes, not the wraparound show around the World Series. We'll have plenty of those coming up this week. This is where you'll be able to listen to the World Series here at Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I believe on other stations on the Sportsnet radio network as well. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me. Boy, the baseball was good this weekend. It was very, very good. Can't start any place other than that. It feels like so often, and I guess this is probably just a little bit of not so much recency bias, but good things bias, where you just remember the great ones. But it feels like all these game sevens we've gotten in baseball, I'm going to go back to the Cubs and Cleveland playing their amazing one for the World Series a few years ago. It feels like these games just constantly live up to the hype. That's where I'll start. I'll bring in Sam McKee now. McKee, how you doing today, bud?
Doing well. It was a beautiful weekend here in the city of Toronto. This really nice fall weather we've had, you know, to just like beautiful weather for, you know, going out, maybe playing a little fall golf. Just The colors are changing. The trees look beautiful, you know. So the winter is coming, but this season has been beautiful and the weather's been beautiful. And since it's fall, Gunnar, you know what that means. It means the Fall Classic is just right around the corner. Starting tomorrow night, like you said, on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, the Sportsnet Radio Network. And boy, oh boy, was that baseball ever good, you know. I was talking to you before we started the show, and I was not as enthralled in the Astros and Rays Game 7 like I was in the Dodgers Game 7. And I even went as far as to tweet during the Rays and the Astros. This is from Sam A. McKee on Twitter. Baseball is no longer the sport I fell in love with. Stud starting pitcher gets pulled after 66 pitches with a shutout. Rays ruined baseball. Okay, so that seems pretty critical of playoff baseball. And then one night later, I tweeted out playoff baseball with 100 exclamation marks and a gif of a guy doing a almost like a praying motion about how happy he is. So I was going back and forth this weekend, as you could tell. But I will say that game last night was amazing. And you know what, Gunnar, I have to say, the fans are great. It's so great to have the fans. I know it's not right. I know there shouldn't be fans. I know the politics behind it. But even the whatever amount of capacity that was at that at Globe Life Park last night, it was great to have the fans. Knowing that Bellinger moment, you could hear them roar. It was awesome having fans.
It was incredible, and I just have to add, you know, hey, everyone enjoys the game how they want to enjoy it. Baseball, at least 5% more fun with me when I'm seeing that collage of Cody Bellinger looking, well, like he's had some extracurriculars going on his face and just being perplexed at the world.
Those memes are incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, resting edibles face, I've seen it described as. That's legal. I can make that joke. Definitely very fun to watch that. And yeah, hey, look, the fans, we're not going to sit here and tell you it's great. I'm not going to tell you smoking's great for you either, but we let people do it. So if it's going to happen, I'm going to enjoy it. Yeah, it was incredible having some people in the building for those moments. I mean, of course, if that's at Dodger Stadium, what an incredible moment it would be. But you know, just having some people in attendance definitely makes it a little more exciting. Now, we did not get the one thing I know you were pining for in this game. We didn't get it. Now, this means we're going to get to see it in game one. But what was the one thing you wanted from that game seven that you didn't get?
I was praying for the Kershaw late innings appearance, because I don't think there's a juicier narrative right now in maybe all of sports, Gunner, than Kershaw, his pursuit of shaking this label of being the sort of underperformer in big spots and overcoming his sort of become a true legend. Because right now he's one of the best pitchers of all time, but you know what? He needs that World Series. He really does. Like, even guys, you know, you look at Greg Maddux, who was sometimes looked upon as not getting it done in the playoffs. He got the one with the Braves in that post lockout year. So, you know, it's just something that he's always needed. And this pursuit of it, and every start, and every big spot, it's just the narratives just flow out of it, Gunnar. And I have to admit, you know, that I am on Kershaw Team Choker Island. I am not afraid to talk about it. I've talked about it on air all the time. I think he's probably the biggest choker in the history of professional sports, just in terms of his regular season acumen compared to what he does in the postseason. But man, I cannot wait to see what happens when he takes that mound tomorrow night. And we saw, you know, I'm not going to compare Hyunjin Ryu to Clayton Kershaw, okay? I'm not going to sit here and do that because they're two very different guys. And Clayton Kershaw is a much better pitcher. But we saw what that Rays lineup did to a soft-tossing sort of, you know, crafty lefty. And I know Kershaw's picked up a little bit more. His fastball has gotten a little better toward in the past couple of years than it was dropping down before. But, I mean, that Rays lineup may not be a great matchup for him. And, boy, oh, boy, you know what we're going to be talking about if he gets lit up game one. And also, quickly, before I throw it back to you, I feel like we have to do a little bit of crow eating, because you and I were texting during that phenomenal.
Oh, I had this. I had this in the notes. I'm happy you brought it up.
And I said, I texted you these exact words. Bellinger is on the Kershaw track to Chokerville. This guy rots in the playoff too. And then you said the Dodgers are going to be in this for another 10 years. He'll grab the mantle from Kershaw. And then he hit the most dramatic home run of the playoffs so far. And you said, ha, 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 sports are something hilarious. So there you go, man. In our face.
Yeah, in our face. I'm happy you threw that out there. Now, the one thing I will say about what I want from game one, I want some mushy middle result where people are able to dig in their toes on either side of the Kershaw's a choker argument. It's no fun if he gives up 8 runs. That's no fun. There's no debate there. Yeah, he choked. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. What would be really fun, though, is a bloop single to really affect things one way or another. So all the guys were saying, no, look at the numbers. Look at his spin rate. It's not his fault. Surely somebody could have come up with it. Chris Taylor could have come up with that ball. No, I don't want that. That's exactly what I want. I want this mushy middle where you're able to say, he gave up 4 in a game one start. Get out of here with this. This guy's a gamer. That's what I would like to see. I think the fun thing is like, there's outside of him just dominating and just being what, you know, we've seen throughout his career. Outside of him being that guy, I don't know that anything's going to really settle it in this playoffs one way or another.
I think if... You don't think, Gunnar, that if they go 7 games, let's say, he starts 1-4-7 and is dominant in all of them, that doesn't change the perception? I think it does.
Oh, no. That does. But outside of that, like, it's just like the bar is almost so high for him to shake this label. He can't be their second best starter. He can't have had a couple of good outings, because you're still going to say, oh, other guys willed him to it. Or, well, maybe I'm speaking for you, but I feel like unless he's truly dominant, that it's still going to linger.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And, you know, I'm really excited for this World Series. I think it's an excellent matchup. And, you know, I'm really happy with how a lot of this sort of, you know, shortened season, weird seasons, you know, you look back to the NHL, and I think there's some debate whether the Dallas Stars were the best team in the West, and, you know, they made it to the finals.
They're not.
The best team won in hockey. No, but the best team won in hockey. And there's no asterisks. Everyone accepts that as a champion. You look at the NBA. Guess what? The best team won, the best player won, and they were probably playing the second best team in the league, maybe the third best team in the league, but I think they were a worthy opponent for the Lakers, as you saw them taking them 6 games with some injuries. And now you look at the World Series, and I think this validates the season as well, because I think this is 2 of the best teams in baseball. A lot of people were picking the Rays to come out of the American League. Just ask Jeff Blair. I think he's talked about it every day on Baseball Central with Kevin Barker, which I absolutely love hearing. Or one of the best radio shows out there, which I love, so... I'm happy that it's 2 worthy opponents. I despise the Rays. I cannot say that enough, that I hate the Tampa Bay Rays with every ounce of my being. So I'm really, really cheering for the Dodgers here. And, like, I just think this is such an interesting team to be an out-of-market fan of, because there's so many people who love baseball like you and I, and we watch playoff baseball and we look forward to playoff baseball every year. We have so much emotional equity in this team because we've seen them in such big spots for so many years now. And these guys like Seager and Justin Turner and, you know, Jock Peterson, Kershaw, Kenley Jansen, all these guys, you feel like you're sort of like a fan of the team, weirdly, but you're not. So I'm cheering for them. I'm really hoping they get over the hump, win the World Series here. And Kershaw has a couple wavery moments where, you know, he's thinking about choking and he doesn't, or he does choke and the Dodgers still win. So I'm really looking forward to this World Series, and I'm cheering so hard for the Dodgers. And I mean, your boy Mookie, hey? Your Red Sox. Oh. What a great trade that is. Let's get going on that.
Honestly, here, okay, look, cards on the table. You might have heard me dance around it, talk around it a little bit. Yeah, I grew up as a Red Sox fan. That is the team I rooted for. And I have so many times in my life rolled my eyes at people saying, oh, I'm not cheering for this team anymore after they traded X player. And then you know what happened? The Red Sox traded Mookie Betts, okay, for my bachelor party. My buds took me to Fenway. Mookie laced a triple at me in the bottom of the first, the very first at bat I ever saw. Like, all that stuff. Loved it. It was incredible. And then they just give up on him for nothing. They could have had Gratterall, who is just throwing the easiest gas I've ever seen in my life in this series. They said no thanks to that. And yeah, I don't know how you could ever say, hey, it's only money. Why? Let's not pay that guy. It's only money. You're the Red Sox. The owner's worth $1 billion. Sign the check. I can only, like, it is inconceivable the fact that a team who, just a couple years removed from a World Series traded that guy. Mind-boggling to me, mind-boggling. But yeah. This is why the Dodgers are the Dodgers, because they don't mess around. There was no, you know what, let's just wait, see if he gets to the open market, then we'll get Mookie there.
No,
just go get him. And that's what the Red Sox were doing in their title window. That's what the Yankees have always done. And that's what makes this Dodgers team so special. So, yeah, he's only had about 27 gold glove highlight level plays. You know, that catch he made last night makes the Endy Chavez catch from the Mets many moons ago look like nothing. And that might not have even been the best catch he made in that series. But other than that, I think it was a great trade for the Red Sox. Wow. I'm truly boggled, McKee. You know, I'm just going to hand it over to you, because otherwise I think I'm just going to scream for the next 20 minutes.
Well, I will say that this is going to help what you're feeling, but there are zero holes in his game. Everything he does is spectacular. He's an incredible at bat every time. He honestly, like, he hasn't been had, like, the eye test versus the numbers. I mean, his average hasn't been very high. I think he just gives a great at bat every time. Excellent base runner, fast. Sick fielder, probably the best right fielder in all of baseball in terms of defense, and he's the coolest goddamn guy in the league. Like, he's just so cool. He's got all the chains, he's got that snarl, his double celebration that he did when he, like, he's kind of spanking the air and all the boys love him. I just can't imagine if my favorite team traded him. I'd be done too, because he's probably the most exciting baseball player in the league. And I mean, guess what? You're telling me right now he's better than Mike Trout. I don't care. Get at me, nerds. At me. Mookie Betts, better than Mike Trout. So, I love Mookie Betts. I love watching him play.
Can I just add one more thing in there? He's 28 years old in the prime of his career. That's all. truly mind-boggling. Honestly, when all it is money, and had to pay Nathan Eovaldi, I guess. But that's enough Red Sox talk on Toronto Sports Radio here. I do want to bring it back to the Blue Jays for half a second before I kick around a couple other things. I will say, watching that game last night, and again, great call by you. You were texting with me saying, Urias has to finish this thing out. There's no way they can go to Jansen. Now, here's the thing Blue Jays fans should probably remember watching this, and we've talked about what makes the Dodgers so special, is that they've had a million guys who on most teams would be the crown jewel, the focal point, just become kind of guys for them. And Urias is the perfect example of that. This guy, when he came up, he was a stud prospect. I remember him making his debut, one of the youngest guys to start for the Dodgers. He got there quicker than anybody. And what was he last night? He was a high-leverage relief guy because you have too many other good starters. Like, it just shows you how good, how deep you have to be. Now, granted, the Dodgers are excessively deep, and you don't have to be them to be ready to compete, but it just shows the chasm between the worlds these two teams live in.
So I'm glad you brought up Urias there. And, you know, talk about guys with checkered past, and, you know, if there was such a thing as a manager choker, I think you'd have to put Dave Roberts in that category. And I thought for sure he was going to overthink that and put Kenley Jansen. You know, they went to break, and I was so expecting to be like, Joe Davis, who had an incredible call last night. Oh, Joe Buck, like, don't get Wally pipped here, buddy, but, like, holy God, that guy is a rising superstar in the announcing game.
He was great.
Inside. But I just expected Joe Davis to be like, and here's Kenley Jansen coming in to close it out. A big moment for the veteran, and him giving up a couple pumpkins and the Dodgers blowing it. That's what I thought old Dave Roberts would have done. But I think he kind of went against sort of the analytics and like the feet. Like, I think he actually used some feel for the game, and he saw what Urias was doing. He was blowing the guys away, and he stuck with his horse, and he got it done. So I was happy to see that. And you're right. Every guy that comes out of the Dodgers bullpen is just like, yeah, the Jays, we're all like, the Jays, like, yeah, yeah, Nate Pearson, yeah. And it's like, the Dodgers have 6 Nate Pearsons. Like, it's just, it's almost unfair the way, because their ability to spend the money, plus they seem to have just an incredible development farm system that they just have all these dudes that just come out with the sickest arms, like Dustin May, Walker Buehler, I mean, Gratterall, where it just go down the line. It's just all amazing guys. So, yeah, Jay's got a way to go to be the Dodgers. I know that's breaking news to everyone on the air listening right now that Jay, the Blue Jays, not the Dodgers. Anyways.
One last thing before we switch gears from baseball. I just have to say I've thoroughly enjoyed John Smoltz throughout all this. Him calling for blood last night. Anytime there was a play at the dish, he's like, you're allowed to do it. Just level him. And I think it was Taylor who was sliding into home, nearly broke his arm trying to get it under the shin guard there. So, yeah, maybe I'm a caveman. Maybe I'm a Neanderthal. We know Buster Posey got hurt. I know, it's sad. But what I wouldn't give for Muncy to have really leveled the catcher at the dish there last night. And I guess Darno it was.
And I have to say, another great point by Smoltz, he's right about when, because Cody Bellinger almost took his arm off doing that stupid celly where they bash like the most like vulnerable part of their arms together, like at high rates. And he's like, it's a stupid thing. It's like, why do you do that? The high five is just fine. Like, why do we have to bash like the ginger part of our arms together? It makes no sense. So yeah, I thought that was pretty smart by Smoltz as well.
Yeah, could you imagine guys going in for like with that much force for like any other meaningful part of the body? It's like, hey, let's just slam knees together, boys.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
Makes no sense at all. What does make sense, Clayton Kershaw getting the ball in game one of the World Series against the Rays. And quickly here, we'll transition to another Tampa Bay team. My guy, Tom Brady. Wow. The ageless wonder. Well, depending week to week. I think the thing I've learned about Brady over the past kind of 3 to 4 years is there's no rhyme or reason for which guy you're going to get week to week. But he could be a bottom five quarterback in the league. But that does not mean the very next week he's not a top 3 to 5 guy. What you saw yesterday, some of the throws he was hitting, he was incredible yesterday. And, you know, are you surprised to see the Brady-Gronk connection looking so good yesterday?
Well, I'll say that I thought that was going to be a blowout the other way when it started. Like, the Packers had the ball for the whole first quarter, and, you know, they were moving the ball easily. You know, Aaron Rodgers was doing Aaron Rodgers things. He got smucked in the end zone. Did you see that when he, like, dove into the end zone? That guy, like, I was like, oh, my God, he's dead. And he gets up and then does that kind of weird, vile celebration that I'm pretty sure I thought I know what it is, but I didn't know if he actually was doing that anyways. I don't really know if we can talk about that on a family-friendly show, but it was a weird Sally. And then that pick six just completely flipped the game. And,
hold on. Okay. Let me jump in there. Did you just turn into Joe Buck when Randy Moss did the moon?
Disgusting act. Yes. I thought he should have said it yesterday. He was calling the game. He should have been like, should have done like a funny throwback and been like, a disgusting would have been act. That would have been hilarious. That would have been amazing. But I just thought that pick six completely changed the game. And, you know, I don't pretend to know a ton about NFL defenses and the ins and outs of how it works. Like, I know when a guy's a good defender and I know when a guy, you know, looks like he's doing good things on the field, but that defense from Tampa looks really, really good. And, you know, if you get that kind of Tom Brady 5 or 6 times more this year, they're going to win a lot of games, and they're a real threat in the NFC. Like, I thought that was a bit of a, like, I mean, not to use a cliche, but I thought that was a bit of a statement game from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So I love, you know what? You know this, Gunner. I love Tom Brady. I've always thought, I love a good, he's a goat in his field. You know, you can't. Oh yeah, he turns his camera on his wall. He's got a picture of Tom Brady. I love Tom Brady. Just your classic hunk quarterback. Just sick stud. Can't hate on him. Gronk is one of the most likable guys in the history of sports. And they just have this connection. And a couple of those were just pure, you know, chemistry. Loved it. Loved that game yesterday. I love seeing Gronk looking like his old self. I'm happy he's happy. I'm happy Tom's happy. And I hope they do well because I'm cheering for Tom. You know, I love to see it. So that was a great game for the Bucs yesterday. And, you know, we can talk more football at 8, but, you know what we want to talk about, buddy.
Yeah, that's right. We want to talk about the Leafs. I have not got to opine about Joe Thornton. I've listened to plenty of my wonderful colleagues, including my co-host tonight, share their thoughts on the beard and what it will bring and the intangibles and all that. Well, somebody who's going to help us get into it all, Dave McCarthy, NHL.com Leafs reporter. He'll join us to discuss all of that and more. Sportsnet Tonight continues. Sportsnet Tonight, Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me. We'll be here until 11 o'clock when we give way to a Kick in the Grass Sportsnet soccer podcast covering all things with Jeff Blair and Dan Riccio. Now, later on tonight, I don't know if we'll get into this, to be perfectly honest. Sam McKee and me are going to explain or try to understand what is the supporter's shield and why wasn't it played for. That's what you call a tease. This is what you call Bring It On. Dave McCarthy, NHL.com, Leafs beat reporter. Dave, how you doing today?
Good. Was that music out of curiosity off the NHL 2003 soundtrack?
You know what? I don't know. I'm looking at producer Tom Young, except I'm not because I can't see him because I'm sitting in my basement right now.
It may
very well have been.
Good, too. I haven't heard it in a long time, but I know it was on one of those NHL games. And whether it was 03 or not, I remember hearing it a lot back in my days of youth where I played video games.
What was the one with Le Cavalier on the cover? Is that 2004?
Oh, jeez.
I think that's the one that was on.
Yeah, okay.
2004.
All right. Well, while Sam McKee Googles video games, I'm going to ask you a question about the Leafs, if that's okay with you, Dave. So there's been a lot of talk about this guy. He's a veteran presence. He had a beard. He doesn't have a beard. He lives in Switzerland now. How's this guy going to help the Leafs? Well, it's because he's a first ballot Hall of Famer lock, Joe Thornton. You've obviously talked a lot about this, thought a lot about this, but I guess my question for you simply is, how do you foresee him being used? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about a lot of different roles. Maybe he's a sheltered kind of third line center. Maybe he plays up on the wing at times with John Tavares. Maybe he's the, you know, the power play two quarterback. Maybe it's a mix of all of those things. How do you see the Leafs using Jumbo?
Well, I think for a number of reasons, what he gives the Leafs is flexibility, right? I mean, whether he is a guy that plays a regular shift as the third line center, I wouldn't put that past him at this point, because remember, he played on a crappy San Jose team a year ago, and he still had 30-plus points. So that's not bad, really, considering how poor the year was for San Jose. And then down the stretch last year, he was one of San Jose's more productive players. So I think he's a guy that lengthens their lineup a little bit. I think he gives them some options on the power play. He'll certainly be on the second unit. But, you know, if the first unit isn't going for two or three or four games, now there's an opportunity to change up the personnel and to give him a shot in that role. And that was something that Sheldon Keefe really didn't have much of an option at doing last year. So invariably throughout the season, your power play will become dull. Now they have an opportunity to use Joe to change it up from a personnel standpoint. He's still one of the best passers in the game. Like, he just really is. There's really no arguing that. So power play is where he should be able to clean up. But I think by and large, guys, the real benefit of having Joe around will be what he's able to offer off the ice. And I know there's still, I really don't understand why there's still a debate about the value of this, but there seems to be, despite the fact that it continues seemingly to be proven correct that there is value in having experience off the ice. There was an absence of that in the room last year. And Joe is a guy that will be able to call out bad play when it needs to be called out. He'll be able to calm the waters when it needs to be calmed. There's so many ebbs and flows of the season as you go through it where you need to lean on some guys that have seen it all and have been there before. And really, I can't think of a better guy than Joe to have around to serve in that role as well.
Yeah, I know there was one clip kind of going around, and I can't remember who the Shark was, but Joe's going to the bench, and the Shark is peeling off with him to go for a line change, and Joe just pushes him back up the ice. Get back. Like, that's the type of kind of no-nonsense there. There's a lot of forward depth on this team. I you know, we can debate how good some of that depth is towards the bottom of the lineup, but is Joe Thornton playing every single night? I mean, who knows how long the next season's going to be, but, you know, do you think there'll be a world where even if it's just a kind of, you know, load management to try to keep him fresh or to try to work other bodies into the lineup, do you expect him to be, you know, dressing regularly?
Yes, I do. And I think ultimately it's all up to Joe. Does he play the second of back-to-backs? Does he play the third and four nights? That type of thing. I think it comes down to how he's feeling, how his body is responding. But I think the intention is that he's going to be a regular player. He's not coming in here to play. I mean, it's so hard to have this discussion because we don't even know how long the season's going to be next year. But let's say it's 82 games. I don't think it will be, but let's say it is. He's not coming here to play 40 games voluntarily, right, where he could be available, but they don't dress him. That's not why they brought him in. They brought him in to play. So I think if he is feeling good and is available to play, I think more often than not, he'll be in the lineup.
So, Dave, I was talking about this on Saturday with Wong, and I wanted to get your take on it. And, you know, this is classic Hoser Canadian take here, but, you know, it means a lot to me that all these guys that are from Ontario now play for the Leafs. There was a long time, you know, where that wasn't the case. And now a lot of them are starting to come home. And like Babcock was talking about when he was on with Bob McCowan on PTS, talking about how they made it safe here. They would all start coming home. It really means a lot to me, and I just kind of get your take on what it means for guys to start coming back to Ontario and play for the Leafs and the guys that are from here.
Well, what I would say to that is the team is in a good position to win, and I think that's a big part of why guys who have grown up in Ontario are interested in coming back and playing for the Maple Leafs. So I think it all comes down to the fact that they've got a promising young core in place here with Matthews, with Marner, with Nylander, with Riley. Throw Freddie Anderson in. Joe Thornton spoke very highly of Freddie Anderson and what he thinks he's all about. That's why I think guys are willing to come home to play in Toronto. And why did John Tavares ultimately decide to come to Toronto? Sure, he wanted to come home, but guy hadn't had a lot of playoff success in his past, and he looked at the Leafs as an opportunity to start to have some playoff success. Why did Joe Thornton come to Toronto? He's 41 years of age. Man hasn't won a Stanley Cup. He's not coming home to Toronto if they're the Ottawa Senators right now. Or, you know, pick any team you want, the Arizona Coyotes. He's coming home because this team, with the proper tweaks to their approach and the proper tweaks to their personnel, and I give Kyle Dubas a ton of credit. I was very critical of the work he had done for the past 2 years. I am singing. Please, I hope he's listening right now, and I hope everybody who thinks I was off my nut a mile and a half the last 2 years is listening right now. I am standing on the rooftop singing Kyle Dubas's praises right now, today, the work he's done over the last couple weeks. I think he's hit it out of the park. So that's why Joe Thornton has come home, because he feels that the team is in a position to contend, and I believe him. I really do. I think the core of this team is as good as any core in the National Hockey League. What I think has happened, certainly last year, is that they have dramatically underachieved, and I think that there is more there to give with better sort of support down the roster and with a tweak to their approach in terms of how they play the game, like Tampa did this year. I think this team can be a significant contender in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, that's high praise for you. And I have to say that I've been critical of Kyle Dubas in the past too. And I have to give him a lot of credit for being able to sort of divert off what he thought was the right way to do things, you know, in terms of his philosophy. But the question, I guess, is an impossible one to answer, and I guess we'll have to see, but I'll get your take on it. I mean, do you think this is definitely, like, the better way to go, or do you think that he's sort of been bullied off of his philosophy too early?
No, 100% the better way to go. The team was terrible last year. Like, really, really not good. And when things went south, there was no one there to lean on. And, you know, you weren't getting anything from down the bottom of the roster. You've talked to a number of guys that call games between the benches. And to a man, everyone I've talked to says this was the most dead bench that they've seen in a long, long time. And being at the games until, you know, we were not allowed to be very regularly anymore all last regular season, you look down at the bench and it was pretty lifeless. You need some characters on that bench. You need some energy on that bench. And guys like Bogosian, who is loud, and guys like Joe Thornton, who is loud, and Wayne Simmons, who is loud, will liven that up a bit. And that was in desperate need on this team. So, no, Kyle Dubas hasn't been bullied off his approach at all. I think he has I think he's taken stock of his experience that he's had in the National Hockey League over his tenure here in Toronto. And I think he's starting to gain a better understanding of what works and what does not work. And what does not work is having the same player all throughout the lineup and having no variety whatsoever. If you don't have some different types of players, some guys who can lean on you a little bit, some guys who can make a little bit tough on you, some guys who are allowed to fire the bench up, it doesn't matter how much talent you have, you're not going to win. And an example that I will use to back this up is, you know, a guy that we came to know and love in this marketplace before he was sent elsewhere, is Alex Anthopoulos. This is a guy that came in when he first took over the Blue Jays, was a numbers only guy. And I remember being down there when I would cover baseball more regularly than I do now, when they acquired Josh Donaldson, they brought in Russell Martin. And I will never forget this press conference. Alex said, look, I understood now that data is important for sure, but you need to have some characters in that room, to paraphrase whatever he said, but guys who will just simply not tolerate losing games. And that's what Donaldson was all about, and that's what Russell Martin was all about when they brought those guys in. And Alex altered his mindset, and he's gone on to have an incredible amount of success. I know the Braves lost last night, but point is he's been in the playoffs just about every stop that he has been since he left the Blue Jays, including the last 2 years he was with the Blue Jays. So I think that's what we're seeing now in Kyle Dubas, I hope, is that he's learned what works and what doesn't, and he's starting to alter his approach. Doesn't mean he was wrong in the past. It means he's understood where the mistakes were, and he's correcting them. That's what good managers do.
Well, and just to carry that analogy a little bit further, I'd say the Braves bench, or dugout, if you will, very, very loud. Yeah, but to pick up on that point, I think it's a very interesting one you make about the dead bench. And, you know, we think back to that first season. One of the most famous clips of the Leafs from early on is Marner and Matthews on the bench singing Living by a Prayer to each other. And not that that's the kind of lively bench you need to have or want to have, but I do just wonder how much of that got kind of beat out of both of those guys to a certain extent the way the past couple of seasons have gone. And, you know, there's so much talk about, oh, a guy like Wayne Simmons makes you play 6 feet taller than you actually feel, or a guy like Reeves allows you to do that. And I honestly wonder if having a guy like Bogo or having a guy like Thornton allows these guys to kind of be those characters on the bench and understand that, you know, it's not always a bad thing. And I sometimes worry if they kind of got the wrong impression of that early on in their tenure, just because of how bright the lights can kind of be here.
Yeah, see, what I'll say to that is I think that the young core really started to feel the pressure last year because they all got paid their money, right? They held the Leafs over the woodshed, so to speak, to torture an analogy, you know what I'm saying, but they held them over the woodshed and they got all the money that they wanted. And then I think they started to feel the pressure, and that's normal, right? When you're 21, 22, 23, suddenly making all the money, it's very different in terms of the expectations and the pressure you put on yourself than when you're 19, 20, making a few hundred thousand bucks, and anything you do is a bonus because nobody expects anything from you. And that's where they really had their success. That first year, 16-17, when Babcock, second year, and they made the playoffs, they lost. Nobody expected them to make the playoffs that year. That was a bonus. Then the next year, they had a great year. They were home and cooled in, like, February. Ultimately lose to Boston in seven games, but they pushed Boston, and they had an unreal regular season, right? So that's where it was sort of the honeymoon phase. But I think some of these young guys really did start to succumb to the pressure a little bit. Here's an example I'll use. This was during the 17-18 season, so it would have been Marner's second year. Come into the locker room, was talking to somebody else, and he was getting undressed, taking his equipment off, and he literally looked at me, and he was like, "Do you need me today? Do you need me today?" I'm like, "Ah, no, I'm okay. Not today, man." He's like, "Okay," and he like bounded off down the hallway. And I was like, okay, that was awesome. But guess what? Last year, never once did he come seeking out media or anything like that. It was, he always seemed like he was, I won't say sullen, but I will say it seemed like he was under a tremendous amount of pressure, and it showed on him. And the young core didn't play loose to the same extent. And then when things would go sideways, I think it really, really got to them. Now you have guys like Bogosian and Simmons and Joe Thornton around. Guess what? Here's the other thing we don't talk about, boys. I don't know. Mitch Marner might be like seventh on my list of guys that I want to talk to now every day when I go into the room, if we can ever do that again. Right? Like, I want to talk to Joe, want to talk to Tavares, want to talk to Bogosian, want to hear from Simmons, Morgan. Like, Marner's low down on the list. Nylander doesn't even register on the list anymore. Matthews, sure, you'd like to talk to him every now and again. But that's the other thing that this does, is it takes some of the onus off these guys that had to answer last year, game in, game out, practice in, practice out. Well, you said all this yesterday, and you went out, you were crap again. Why? Rinse, repeat. You said all this the day before, and now you went out again, you were crap. Why? And you do that 3 months in a row, 4 months in a row, it wears on you. This is the other thing that bringing in these vets does. It takes some of that pressure off some of the younger guys so that maybe they can get back to playing free and loose and easy when they were having their success.
And if the season goes sideways, Joe Thornton just explained 82 terrible games. So, no, oh, we hope that doesn't happen. Definitely not. Dave McCarthy, so much fun. Really enjoyed the chat. Thanks for coming on.
Good, boys. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
There he goes, Dave McCarthy, and our crack producer letting us know that was Franz Ferdinand's Take Me Out, and it was in a couple of different video games. It was in NHL 05 and Madden 05, the double dip for Franz Ferdinand, Take Me Out. Good for them. Good year by Dave. A lot to chew on in that conversation there. I you know what? I think it's a lot to chew on. So we're going to step aside here. We'll continue with some more Leafs talk on Sportsnet tonight. Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me. We just had a great, great chat with Dave McCarthy, NHL.com, Leafs beat writer. There was so much to get into there with him, and I think where I want to start with you, and who knows where this will go, we didn't even mention Ilya Mikheyev's name. He's got an arbitration hearing later this week, potentially, as long as the two teams don't get a deal done. We'll get into that in a second, but I think the big question for a lot of people is just kind of... What exactly has Kyle Dubas done this offseason? And how much of it has been a change of his direction? And how much of it has been a taking advantage of a market that has kind of highlighted these type of players? Because I really do wonder if Joe Thornton would have been sitting out there at 1 year, $700K last year, and he would have been willing to sign with the Leafs, I'm pretty sure Kyle Dubas would have loved to have had him on the team at that contract last year. Wayne Simmons, 1.5. Okay, maybe that's a bit of a different look. But that's my question for you. How much do you think he's actually changed his mentality or his idea for what makes the perfect blueprint of how to build a team?
That's a great question, Gunnar. And I think you have to look at it and say a lot. I don't think he would have, because I think he had an opportunity to trade for Wayne Simmons last year at the deadline, didn't do it. I think that he kind of was doing his plan. I think You know, you look at the signings that he made. You know, he signed Pierre Engvall after two good games. He thought he was part of the core. And, you know, we saw what happened after that. He had one non-David Ayers goal after January. So I think that he did change. And I think that, you know, I brought it up with Dave McCarthy there, but I don't think it's necessarily a fold or like, you know, he gave in to public perception, but I think he realized, I think he's smart enough to understand that what he had wasn't getting it done. And like I screamed at you about for many years, or not many years, maybe many months, maybe let's
say 12 months. It feels like years. Just feels like years. That's all.
That this lineup needed changeups in the bottom half. You couldn't keep having dollar store versions of the top six run out there every time. You needed to have guys who did different things in the bottom half of the lineup. And boy, oh boy, you look at the bottom half of this lineup now, and it looks completely different. And you know what? I also think that this kind of has, Dubas sort of has the ability to kind of switch back and forth between philosophies because of the one-year sort of contracts that he's going to be signing for the remainder of the core's contracts, right? Because they're not going to be signing big-name free agents. Like, they're never going to be – well, not big – big name's the wrong way to put it. Big-money free agents, because Joe Thornton is a large name and maybe one of the biggest names in the history of the game. But I think he will be able – if this sort of philosophy doesn't work, and you know they're too slow and they're past their prime, and the bottom half doesn't look any better than it did last year, I think he has the ability to the following year to kind of go back and revert and go back to a bottom six that looks a little more like it did before. So I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see what this looks like. I mean, just to think about Joe Thornton in a Leafs jersey is extremely – it's just wild. 2020 is just a – wild year, but in 97 Joe Thornton wearing the old Team Canada number, it's gonna be crazy. So I think I would say that Kyle Dubas did change his, just to go back to your original question, he did sort of change his philosophy.
So I'll be honest, I don't know about that, because we know the story about Bogosian came out, I think it was on the 31 Thoughts podcast 2 weeks ago now, where the Leafs canceled the meeting with him after the David Ayers game. And the thought of Simmons was out there at the deadline, could have traded for him, and they didn't. And I really do think that whether you want to call it Dubas, whether you want to call it the brass, whether you want to call it Sheldon Keefe as well, I think they were so, you know, for lack of a better term, disgusted with what they saw from that team last year. The idea of going out and adding anything, even for free, was a non-starter for them. I think they really wanted to see what they kind of had. And unfortunately, now I don't think this is a forever indictment on Matthews, on Marner, on Nylander, on Tavares. But unfortunately, at that moment in time, not ready. Like, not ready to do it by themselves. So I think that it's, I think you're right. I think it's a slight tweak. But I think just the fact that they had a meeting set up with Bogosian in, and they called it off because of how embarrassing that loss to the Hurricanes was, I think it kind of shows that they were already flirting with these ideas, thinking about these ideas. I'm not saying it's there's been no change to the thought process whatsoever, but I think of it as a kind of slight tweak as opposed to an about face.
Okay. I don't know. I just think that he wouldn't have done this. And I think that his dream scenario was to have the guys that he sort of developed up to the Marlies. You know, you look at Andreas Janssen, you look at Kasperi Kapanen, you look at guys that have come up to the Marlies system when he was the GM down there. Engvall, Freddy Gauthier, you know, Justin Hall, all these guys. He looks at these guys and wishes that they were are part of the winning core. That they sort of did the Tampa Bay Lightning thing where they came up from there and, you know, they won down there and they came up here and they started to push this team. And that just wasn't the case. And I think he really took him a while to sort of let go of that. And he realized that, you know, I got to have some real guys, some real veterans, some real sort of thing in the bottom half. And I think that is a shift in philosophy. What you're saying is also true. But I definitely think that there was a shift in philosophy. I think it's, you're making a hell of a case there. But I think it's hard to discount the fact that, like, he didn't change his tune completely this offseason.
I've been rewatching The Newsroom, a lot of Aaron Sorkin dialogue, so maybe I'm just picking it up and just really powering it through there, and that's what's leading me to make these great arguments now. So I kind of talked about the Mikheyev thing earlier there. We saw his arbitration numbers coming out now. He's not going to get what he asked. I think it was 2.5 that he asked for. The Leafs have asked for $1 million.
2.7.
to seven. Okay, yeah, that's a problem. Now, here's the thing. He's not going to get anywhere near that. He's played 30-something regular season games, you know, a handful of bad playoff games for him, and I think we all understand why. He was coming off a catastrophic injury, hadn't played, blah, 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 blah. The problem with this is the Leafs right now, in terms of their cap space, I believe they're kind of flirting it around $1.4 million. Still got to do Dermott. Still got to do this Joey Anderson character they're very happy about from the Janssen trade. You know, what do you make of McKayev? And do you worry at all about him getting too high an award in arbitration?
Yeah, I do worry about that. I have to say, you know, I was, like everybody else, I was pretty impressed with him to start the year last season. You know, I thought he had a great start until he had that horrific injury against the Devils. I think he is an interesting guy, a guy that, you know, can really sort of present, you know, he's a guy that you want in your lineup. I think he can do a lot of different things, you know. I think he's a good penalty killer. He's a guy that can, he's really good at picking off passes. You know, he's got that sort of sneaky length, good speed, kind of a, I think a good sort of third liner. A kind of guy that can sort of fringe up into your top six, but I'd be hesitant to give him anything over, you know, $1.5 million. Even that seems steep. So I'm hoping this turns out to be more of like a 1.2 or a 1.3 would be my ideal scenario, because even I think that's a little steep. And you know, who knows what Dermott's gonna get? But yeah, I don't really love the idea of giving him anything over two. That's for sure. But I guess my top number I would go would be 1.5, I think. And even that would be stretching it a little bit. But I think there's potential there. I think there's potential for a guy who's a meaningful contributor to the Leafs. But I think you have to be a little bit hesitant when you start talking about $2 million. You know, I mean, like, you look at what Joe Thornton just got. Is he going to be better than Joe Thornton next year? He could be. He's younger. He's in his prime. But, like, it's hard. You know, it's hard to justify spending. Like, it's, I guess I'm just sort of looking at what Joe Thornton used to be and kind of comparing him to that. But Ilya Mikheyev getting twice as much as Joe Thornton seems like a tough pill to swallow for me. But I'm hesitant to give him a lot, I will say.
Yeah, that's well said. I agree. Now, the thing I'd add to that, a couple things the Leafs kind of, I don't even know if they're going in their favor or not, but things you should keep in mind with this. Now, because it was Mikheyev who filed for arbitration, the Leafs have an option of going 1 or 2 years. So if it's a number they like, they're able to get it for 2 years, which obviously is a good thing. The other part of this that is going to play into their factor is whatever he gets awarded at, I don't think there's a chance of him kind of running back to the KHL, because if he ever wants to come back to the NHL, he's got to play on that deal for the Leafs or whoever holds his right. So I don't think that there's a world where that happens. Now, the one thing about this that could potentially complicate things, and hat tip to Elliot Friedman, he pointed this out on Writer's Block today. Dan Milstein, the agent for Mikheyev, also the agent for the Leafs' first-round pick in this past month's draft, 15th overall. So that, obviously, you don't want to jeopardize the relationship there. I think from all accounts, the Leafs and Mikheyev have a really, really good one, so I don't think there's too much worry about it getting contentious there. But anytime you share an agent with the guy you just took as a first-round pick, adds a little more complications. The fact that he is in Russia, you never know when those guys are going to come over. So definitely a lot of interesting pieces with this. We'll know a little more on Wednesday when we get the hearing.
Yeah, and I think Dan Milstein also represents the goalie the Leafs took in the fourth round, I want to say. So I lots of Dan Milstein fingerprints on the Leafs. And like, I don't want to turn this into the crap on Ilya Mikheyev hour, because I do think he's a good player, and I think he does have some potential to be a really good player for the Leafs. But that 2.7, he's obviously not going to get that, but that jumped off the page to me. And I just, that injury was scary, and he was the MVP of camp and then was a capital G ghost for all five games against the Columbus Blue Jackets. So we'll see where that goes. Nothing more exciting than arbitration hearings, so we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, get excited, people. Hot arbitration talk. We might even get some lawyers on this station to break it all down. Oh, yeah, that's right. Daniel Love Wallach, it. I'm sure you'll hear from him.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. Who's to say? Who you will hear from, though? Kalen Jones, NFL writer for The Ringer. Bills, tough day for them. What is Josh Allen? Oh, you know, that's one of my favorite hobby horses. We'll get into all that when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
We are the most important part of your bedtime routine. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Tonight, Brent Gunning, Sam McKee here. Tough night for the Bills, yes, playing a rare early Monday nighter, falling to the Chiefs. I don't think anybody's too surprised by that. Joining us now to kick around all things in the NFL, Kalen Jones with the Ringer. Kalen, first time getting to talk to you. Thanks so much for jumping on tonight. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we will. We'll start with the quasi-local team here, the Bills. I think Josh Allen. He's maybe one of the most referendumed players here. Every single week is a referendum on exactly how good this guy can be. There has been high praise for him up until the last couple of weeks. What do you make of the kind of improvement you've seen from Josh Allen? And I guess my kind of follow-up question to that is, how much of it is him making strides, and how much of it is Brian Daboll just really having this offense clicking and making it so much easier for Allen?
So it's a mixture of both. You know, with Allen, you know, I would say where he's taking the biggest leap is in his accuracy this year. I mean, you look at the stats over the course of his career. Entering the season, he was like 12-0 in games where he completed 60% of his passes. So, you know, my joke with people, you know, talking about the league was really, you know, the Bills are a fascinating team because if Josh Allen, you know, played at a, you know, decent level, even a solid level or a competent level, you know, as a passer, you know, the sky's kind of the limit for this Buffalo Bills team. And then when you factor in, like you mentioned, Brian Daboll, like what they've done offensively, what he's been able to do as far as, you know, making Allen comfortable and utilizing his skill set, both as a passer, giving a lot of easy passes, and then even allowing the game to kind of spread down the field, adding a weapon to Stephon Diggs, stretch the field and open things up in the intermediate game, and then also making use of his legs and then, you know, incorporating some of that run game where you had Singletary and Zach Moss included. So it's been a pretty decent, you know, balance between Allen taking, you know, leaps, I guess, within his development, also being more familiar with the system, and also what Daboll's doing in terms of, you know, utilizing his quarterback and, you know, fitting the system to accommodate what he does well.
So I wanted to move over to the NFC, and I wanted to talk to you quickly about Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who I was extremely impressed with yesterday. And I got to ask you a question about those two teams. Do you think that game was more about the dominance of the Bucs, or was it more about sort of the ineptitude of the Packers? I'm not sure who was better or who was worse.
What I would, you know, take away from that game, I would take away that Tampa Bay's defense is legit. And, you know, like, even before the season, when you look at the numbers from last year, Tampa Bay's defense ranked, you know, amongst one of the best defensive units in, you know, the NFL last year, specifically in what they were doing against the run. Their front seven is one of the best in the NFL. We talk about Levante David being one of the most underrated linebackers in the league. Ndamukong Suh, you know, along the defensive line. What they're able to do there as far as generate pressure and also stifle opponents' running game, it's very impressive to them what they've been able to build within the secondary. There's a bunch of exciting young players, Carlton Davis, Antoine Winfield Jr., Sean Murphy Bunting. There's a competent defense already in place there, and really they've taken a lot of strides, I guess, you know, within these first couple weeks. You know, we saw them in the shootout, you know, kind of with the Chargers, and I believe 2 weeks prior. But this week, they really did a good job of taking away, you know, Aaron Rodgers' options. And I think when you're looking at the Packers, I feel like this kind of highlighted the fact that they don't have any real star playmakers outside of Davante Adams and Aaron Jones. Once, you know, the Buccaneers were able to take away Jones and Adam within the passing game, and it really left, you know, Aaron Rodgers without too much to do. At the same time, you know, the Packers' offensive line, you know, was not doing a great job protecting Rodgers, and he seemed a little bit rattled and his accuracy wasn't there. So I think that they'll definitely improve down the road. I think that the Packers are, you know, going to bounce back, especially this week when they play Houston. But, you know, moving forward, I think that, you know, what we saw from Tampa Bay's defense is definitely legit. If these two teams were to meet again, maybe the score would be a little bit closer, but this Tampa Bay defense is just as dominant as they proved.
Yeah, I mean, the defense was definitely what gave a lot of people confidence that Brady would be able to kind of make it work down there, even if he wasn't at his peak. And it's funny, I'm finding myself feeling the same way about Tom Brady that I do sometimes with a quarterback at the beginning of their career. You know, we think improvement is going to be linear. We go back to Josh Allen, and we think he's this good year one. He'll be a little better year two, a little better year three, a little better year four. And conversely, on the other side, you know, you think when a guy starts to decline, it's going to go off this cliff. But what kind of amazes me for Brady is he can have these games where he looks done. He looks like he's unable to hit anybody, but I still know, just based on what I've seen for the past handful of years, that he's still going to have games like yesterday where it feels like he's just able to, you know, I don't want to be hokey and say just channel it, but I don't know how else a guy is able to fluctuate so much between mediocre and truly great. You know, are you surprised that the kind of swings for Brady are that large, or is this kind of what you expect for a guy later in his career?
It's a little bit, you know, of a mix of, you know, the fact that Brady is so long into his career, you know, physically he's just not the same player. But at the same time, you know, there was no real preseason. He's in his first new system in literally 20 years. So I'm not too surprised, you know, by, you know, the little ups and downs, I guess, that we've seen throughout the course of the year. Because it hasn't been, you know, like you mentioned, like it hasn't been linear progression. There's been some weeks where we've seen Tom Brady look great, and then there's other weeks where he's kind of been meh. And even yesterday, he wasn't all that great. He was efficient. He went 17 of 27, 166 yards and two touchdowns, wasn't sacked. And, I mean, he did a pretty good job, you know, managing the game and putting his team in position to win. I think that the running game really helped set all that up, and really what the defense was able to do against Green Bay in terms of dictating how the game went and allowing Brady to kind of flow with things. But I don't think that Brady is as much of a detriment to this team, you know, as much as people are saying. When you look at the injuries that Tampa Bay's offense has had, you know, through the first 6 weeks of the season, I'm not surprised at all that, you know, it's taken this team so long to gel, especially when, you know, Brady is coming in and there's a completely revamped offensive system. Not to mention throwing Rob Gronkowski into the mix, you know, Ronald Jones in the mix, Tyler Johnson. There's just so many new names within this offense, you know, and it centers all around Brady, what he can do. So as long as he's able to, you know, function at a, you know, competent level, I think that, you know, Tampa Bay, you know, arguably could, you know, end up being a Super Bowl competitor. I believe that, you know, they have a real shot at making it if Brady can figure things out and continue to play at a decent rate.
All right, so let's look over at Tom's old team with the New England Patriots. And there's one word to call that game yesterday. And well, there's lots of words, but I'll go with bad, stinky. There's tons of different words we could use. But the question I guess I have for you is, how concerned should New England Patriots fans be about their team? Or do you think that's a one-off performance?
I wouldn't be too concerned, only because, you know, Cam Newton had only gotten, I believe, one practice in, you know, coming back from the COVID-19 list or recovering from, you know, the virus. So I wasn't overly concerned. Obviously, you know, the Broncos aren't, you know, the prettiest team to lose to on paper, considering the injuries they've had defensively and, you know, just offensively. Actually, their entire roster, you know, they've been banged up a lot, and they weren't really able to capitalize, you know, on their scoring chances yesterday. But, you know, like that being said, I think, you know, moving forward, you know, week to week, I think that New England is still going to be very much within the playoff mix. I still think yesterday was kind of an anomaly as opposed to it, you know, being the norm. You know, once Cam Newton is healthy, I think that this offense is going to be able to go a little bit better than it did yesterday, as opposed to, you know, how many times its tires were spinning or, you know, the random turnovers that it had. It just didn't seem like Cam Newton was playing at his full capability, especially coming off, you know, the COVID-19 list. So I think that, you know, Patriots fans should still be confident in what this team is capable of moving forward.
Oh, and he dove on the fumble. Everyone was very, very excited to see that. Oh, I know, yeah, a lot of people were making way, way too much about that. But, yeah, I tend to agree with you. Obviously, the Broncos were going through the same weird schedule stuff, but I think you kind of have to throw that game out. They've been trying to play it for however long. You're just getting your quarterback back. I think, yeah, you just kind of throw that game out. A team who doesn't want to throw any games out because they've been perfect, well, at least record-wise. Pittsburgh Steelers, they've looked great. Been a bit of a resurgence, but I look at who they've beaten and I find myself asking, just how good is this team really?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because look, their victories are against the Giants, the Broncos, the Texans, the Eagles, and, you know, look, they curb stomped the Browns. I mean, granted, you know, but the Browns wins aren't all that impressive either, and they haven't looked good against, you know, competent teams. what their victory against the Browns did tell me, though, is that they're at least the number two team within the AFC North. And, you know, when you look at that front seven, they literally have the most dominant pass rush in the league. Their pressure rate is, you know, 10 percentage points higher than second place. T.J. Watt is a force. Vaughn Tuitt is a force. It's unfortunate that they lost Devin Bush for the year, but when you look at what that defense is capable of, coupled with Ben Roethlisberger playing at a decent level, I don't even think he's hit top gear yet in regards to getting acclimated to, you know, the system, not just acclimated to the system, acclimated with his teammates once again, where you talk about the weapons that they have in Chase Claypool, Deontay Thomas, and Juju Smith-Schuster. I think that, you know, the Steelers have a really good shot of contending for that AFC title. I think this week will be a really good gauge for them when they go up against the Titans on the road. But I do think that, you know, that the Steelers are a really, really interesting team. And they were honestly, like, one of my favorite teams, you know, coming into this year to compete within the AFC. So it's not too surprising. But I think this week we'll have, like, our first, you know, real telling sign of whether or not this is a team that's capable of competing for an AFC championship or not.
All right, this is a really complicated question for you, buddy, but the Jets. Man, oh, man. Like, is there a worse franchise in all of sports to be a fan with? It's just they're just terrible every year. Like, is there anything they could ever do to fix this? I know you'd probably be a lot richer if you could, but, man, it's just brutal. Every year, they're never good. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And it comes down – I feel like it comes down to culture. You know, Adam Gase has been given, you know, kind of a lot of leeway, and it's kind of shocking that they haven't, you know, completely press reset like we've seen the Texans do and the Falcons do already this year. But at the same time, I guess, you know, at this point, when you look at the roster, when you look at the rest of the schedule, I'm not sure who, you know, the Jets are beating on this guy. They literally just got shut out against the Dolphins, who, you know, what you would assume are, you know, at least they'd be able to at least put up, you know, a competitive fight in an in-division rivalry match like that, but they just weren't. So, I mean, like, moving forward, you know, this is a team that's probably in line for, you know, the top pick. They have a lot of young talent to build around. Sam Darnold, you still don't really know what you have there with him. And, you know, if they were to fire Gase at the end of the year, it gives you the potential, you know, maybe move on from Darnold or, you know, whichever regime comes in afterwards, you know, kind of select their own guy in Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields or whomever. But, you know, like, that being said, I think that at this point the Jets are kind of, you know, tanking, for, you know, lack of a better word. They're kind of looking forward towards pressing the reset button. I don't know anybody on the inside in that organization, but, you know, that's just the trajectory that they're headed towards at this point. And, you know, you can't really blame them when you want to ensure yourself of, you know, a proper rebuild. You got to recoup as much picks as possible. They were able to, you know, add some more picks by trading away Jamal Adams. It's unfortunate that they didn't get anything for Le'Veon Bell this past week. But, hey, I mean, like, whoever does end up, you know, in the likelihood that Adam gets his fired, whoever does inherit his situation, you know, it's not a great situation to be in. But, look, if there's a full arsenal to work with, I believe they have cap space moving forward. So we'll see what happens. But this year is just not the Jets' year, plain and simple.
I kind of like your boss, Bill Simmons' take that they can't fire Adam Gase. He's way too valuable to the tanking effort, so I don't know that we'll see him go. Now, he's a terrible coach, or at least he's proved to be this year. Well, Mike Vrabel is the master of the dark arts. We saw what he did last year with the intentional offside. Oh, yeah. Back at it again this week with intentionally putting 12 men on the field. I mean, I've seen some people kind of rolling their eyes at it. It's a little cheap. For me, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. I love this stuff from him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, like you said, you know, if you're not cheating, you know, within, I guess, like, you know, the illegal legality of it, like, there's a very blurred line there, but I think it's fine. You know, it's gamesmanship. It's great. You know, like, that being said, though, I mean, it's really fascinating because, you know, there's, you know, not compared to college football, but there's all that talk about how, you know, Nick Saban's assistants never succeeded, particularly against him. You know, Kirby Smart at Georgia, you know, has done a really good job, and I'm sure there's others that I'm missing, but, you know, when you look at the Bill Belichick tree in the NFL, I mean, Josh McDaniels didn't do that great as a head coach. Matt Patricia is not doing well as a head coach right now. But Mike Vrabel has, you know, found a lot of success, literally ended up guiding Tennessee to, you know, the AFC Championship game last year, and they're undefeated right now. And, you know, I believe, you know, whatever he's doing with that franchise, aside from them not taking COVID-19 protocol seriously, they've done a really fantastic job in terms of, one, constructing their roster, and then, two, you know, kind of, you know, building around the success that they've had. You know, particularly when you look at the running game. It'll be interesting to see how well Ryan Tannehill continues to do. You know, he really relies on what they do on the ground. But without Taylor Lewan protecting him, I'm sure that we'll probably see fewer pass attempts from him. I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, you kind of see his attempts go down moving forward. But, I mean, when you look at his passing weapons, A.J. Brown, Corey Davis, I mean, those guys, Janu Smith, like, that's a very, very talented, you know, playmaking core on top of what they have defensively. So they've done a really good job. You know, Mike Vrabel really should be commended for the job that he's done, you know, over the course of the past few seasons.
Yeah, he's pretty – there's a lot of talk about coaching trees. Well, if it were a coaching forest, there'd be a lot of stumps that never got off the ground from Belichick. But Vrabel is definitely looking for a little bit better of a career than some of the other names you mentioned there. Kalen, thoroughly enjoyed the chat tonight. Hopefully we get to do it again down the line.
Thanks a lot, bud.
Of course, guys. Thanks for having me.
There he goes, Kalen Jones, The Ringer. Check him out on Twitter. Read his latest column there as well. McKee, I loved what we heard from him there. A lot to jump in on. Anything that jumped out from you from that chat?
Titans are sick. They're a great team, yep. Man. Honestly, like I really love watching them play. Derrick Henry is probably my favorite player in the league. He's just a robot. This guy is just a true. I don't know. Like, he never has a facial expression. Even the way he runs is very robotic. You just, like, you can't take him down. He's just ridiculous. I love watching him play. And, man, if you're a Dolphins fan, watching Ryan Tannehill play like this must burn you. I know you got Tua there. I know you got Fitzmagic there, who's been pretty good. I mean, the Dolphins aren't having that bad a year at all. 3-3, you know, like, they're right in that division race. But, boy, oh, boy, Ryan Tannehill is looking like a top 5, top 10 guy in the league right now. He's slinging it all over the place. That play he did with the fake spike back shoulder fade to AJ Brown in the corner of the end zone yesterday. I'm loving the Titans, and I think that game this weekend is going to be excellent. Steelers Titans, which a bit of a who's for real game. I'm looking forward to it. No, so the Titans are one of my favorite teams to watch right now for sure.
Well, I'm gonna pull it back to something everybody loves. You know, we say no one wants to hear about your fantasy team. Well, no one wants to hear about your high school sports exploits. But we had a guy on my high school football team who just simply went by the name Captain. He had huge dreads, and we had to order a special helmet for him. So we all had white helmets. He had a blue helmet because it was the only one we could find that could fit it. And I just, every time I see Derrick Henry being bigger, stronger, and faster than everyone else with that massive dread, it's all I can think of. It is a flashback to my high school days. If you're out there listening, you're not, but definitely, it's exactly where my mind goes there. I do think there's some other things.
Oh, sorry, Derrick Henry's. It's funny you mentioned high school, and Derrick Henry's high school stats are the funniest thing in the world, right? So, I think it's a good correlation there.
Oh man, it looked like he was in high school when he threw Josh Norman to the sun a couple of weeks ago. There, we all know the picture of him with Mark Ingram standing there at half the middle of the field there for the coin toss at one of the SEC championships games. He's a huge monster of a man, and it doesn't seem fair that he can move like that. Now, there's a lot of buzz right now for him being MVP, and if you look at the numbers, you can easily make the case. But I still have to feel like when it's all said and done, some quarterback is going to grab this thing by the mantle and end up winning MVP.
Yeah, it's going to be Russell Wilson. It's Russell Wilson's year this year, I think. I think, you know, much has been said about how he hasn't even had a vote, and there's all that sort of there's a big time narrative with him, and I think that's sort of heading in that direction. Like, the MVP in all leagues is sort of a narrative. It's a narrative award, so I think it's definitely heading in that direction for him. But I was just pulled up Derrick Henry's high school stats really quickly, and I just wanted to just quickly, you know, I think this is worth noting. On September 21st against Andrew Jackson in a 45-28 win, he had 45 carries for 510 yards and 6 touchdowns. So, not bad. Not bad. That'll play.
Is that good? Is that good? Also, if you would have given me a guess, Andrew Jackson High would have been one of the first 5 I would have guessed for a high school in the South. That just would have been a guess for me. Very happy it's not a Confederate general, quite honestly. There's a lot going on in the NFL. I think I just think that Titans team is so much fun. Vrabel is always up to these tricks. Now, one thing I do want to touch on before we go. Your Steelers, incredible 5-0. We heard about the beatdown. Now, there is one part of the Steelers, though, I'm very disappointed in, and I think it's going to surprise you. It's our guy, Chase Claypool. I saw a lot of news on Twitter this weekend. He doesn't like the Mapletron nickname. He doesn't like it. And I'm just disappointed. I mean, it's him. He's allowed to go by whatever he wants, but it just feels like way too good a handle not to like.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know what I kind of hearken that to? And I saw that too, and it made me think of it. It really is similar to Kevin Durant spurning the Durantula nickname, which is an all-time nickname. I think the Durantula completely, I think that could have shifted the narrative about him his whole career. I think more people would like him if his nickname was the Durantula, right?
So that's, well, I don't even think that's the best Kevin Durant nickname that he
does. Oh, I know where you're going to go. The Slim Reaper.
Yeah, the Jalen Rose one, which is incredible. Like, that is an all-time. Can you imagine? All he had to do was not literally go play anywhere else other than the Warriors and go by the Slim Reaper, and he would have been the most beloved player. Well, maybe not other than LeBron. But honestly, he would have been so, like, it would have done a complete 180 on public perception. Obviously, the Warriors thing. That is just such an incredible handle, and it's borderline blasphemous that he doesn't go by it. Same with Chase Claypool and Mapletron.
I will say that we were talking about our favorite players in the league, and boy, oh boy, Chase Claypool is on track. Canadian, playing for the Steelers. I love him. You know, he's like he's just a classic big receiver, fast, can do it all, great hands. Love him. Love, love, love him. So I'm thrilled that he's doing so well, but man, you know, good old Browns, love the Browns, you know, they're like, oh, we're feeling ourselves, you know, we're heading into this game, you know, it's a big test game, and it's like 1 minute into the game, Baker Mayfield, pick six, right away, game over, they're never even close, so, good old Browns, attaboy Andy McNamara, keep loving those Brownies,
oh,
buddy.
You beat me to it. Oh, I wanted to get the dig in on McNamara, you beat me to it.
Yeah, so no, that was a hell of a game for the Steelers yesterday. Big blow losing Devin Bush, though. That's like their best defensive player. So, I mean, they've got a lot of good players on defense, but that's a huge blow for them. He's kind of the captain of their defense. But other than that, you know, that was a really impressive victory.
Yeah, well said. We'll see if they can keep it going. 5-0, nothing wrong with being perfect. But as we said, it's not like they've exactly been beaten up on the league's best. Somebody who is the league's best, well, it's the two teams left playing for the World Series. We'll kick that all around. Little baseball chat when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
Sometimes you gotta bleed and know that you're alive and have a soul.
But it takes, oh, we're about 22 hours away from Choker Gate in Major League Baseball. No, we'll wait until after the game to discuss all that. Game one of the World Series starts up tomorrow. Dodgers and Rays. Clayton Kershaw on the bump, joining us now to tee up the World Series, probably to tell us how wrong we are about Clayton Kershaw being a choker. Dan Zimborski joining us now with Fangraphs. Dan, let's just start there. Me and my co-host Sam McKee here, I'll say it, we're a little Neanderthal adjacent at times, and we just want our big stars to win. We'll get to Mike Trout in about 10 years. We have a lot of time for him, but right now, Kershaw is the guy we're focused on. We think a little chokish at times. Please tell us, I'm sure, why we're wrong.
Well, I mean, you're not completely wrong. He has pitched relatively poorly in the postseason compared to his regular season performances. I'm personally, I don't really use the term choking that much because I remember being a kid in high school with a 65-mile-per-hour fastball who lost pretty much every time I threw. So I hate to use that word. But for whatever reason, you can't ignore the fact that he has pitched worse in the postseason than the regular season. And that's a storyline that he's, you know, he's going to be 33 next year. He's running out of time to kind of flip that script, so to speak.
Yeah, so I just think that there's no, I was talking about it in our first segment, I just don't think there's any juicier storyline right now, and maybe in all of sports, than a Clayton Kershaw World Series start. I just think that all the ways it can go and all the different sort of narratives that can be built around it, it's got to be one of the best things that we can have in sports is a Kershaw start, right?
Yeah, it'll be fun. There'll be a lot of hoopla around it. I think that the television networks were kind of hoping for a Dodger-Houston rematch because there's all sorts of storylines you can do with that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I was hoping for that, too, because of the – I didn't really want to see the Rays make the World Series, but the Astros and Dodgers would have been good. But I guess I'll start with this. Where do you see the advantage in this World Series? Because you look at these two teams, and they kind of, in terms of what they are, kind of mirror each other. Not in terms of how much they spend, that's for sure. But where do you see the big advantage in this series?
Well, what it comes down to is that the Dodgers do spend a lot more money than the Rays do. And they're, you know, just as analytically inclined as the Rays are. You have quite a bit of overlap of personnel, most notably the president of the Dodgers, Andrew Friedman, who comes from Tampa. I think that where the Dodgers have the edge is that their offense is downright scary, and it's deep. The Rays can come in with all sorts of matchups from their bullpen, but the Dodgers have someone for every matchup. You know, you bring in a righty up, you have Jock Peterson. I mean, they scored nearly 6 runs a game playing in Dodger Stadium half the time this year. It's a frightening offense, and when a game against the Dodgers gets out of control, it can get out of control very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing about this Dodgers lineup, and, you know, me and my co-host here, we've been talking about it so much today, is that it's kind of mind-boggling how deep this team has been for so long. And I think, you know, you expect teams in the playoffs, yeah, they're going to be deep. They're going to have bats off the bench. But it seems like every year or every other year, they're kind of unearthing another guy to just keep this lineup, you know, longer and longer. And like you said, you know, you look at all the different matchups. There's so many different ways. I'll kind of jump to the Rays looking at their starting pitching there. We know it's going to be Glasnow getting the ball in game one. Out of their kind of 3 front-of-the-line starters there, how do you think they kind of profile against the Dodgers? I mean, we know they handle fastball as well. What do you make of how those 3 guys kind of are set up against the Dodgers?
I think what it comes down to is how deep in games they can go, because even though they did win the series, the Rays pitching wasn't quite as sharp at times as you would hope it would be. And against the Dodgers, that's risky. You look at Blake Snell's last start. Yeah, he actually had a pretty good line, but the Astros were not swinging at his fastballs or changeups. They were just going out of the zone. They were taking him, drawing walks. And the Dodgers, they're a dangerous team when you start doing that. And I think that the Rays do get a little bit of a reprieve in that there are actually rest days during the World Series when there weren't in the ALCS. But I think I'd like to see, you know, Morton go 6 and Snell go 6 and keep that bullpen fairly rested, because the Dodgers are as deep as the Rays. So if it goes to one of those crazy extra inning games, the Rays don't necessarily have an advantage where they would have against, say, the Astros.
Yeah, you know who else would like to see a starter go deeper than 6th innings? His name is Brent Gunning. He's talking to you on the phone right now, and he's a host on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Again, this goes back to my little Neanderthal comments from the beginning of it, but, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and debate the merits of, is it smarter to let a guy go deep? I know it's not, but even you, I mean, you are as analytically inclined as they get. Do you not find yourself kind of pining at times for the old days of this guy's going to take the ball and go 7 innings and you know exactly what you're going to get? Or is this, you know, maybe a more fun version of baseball for you, where you're wondering exactly what matchup's coming around the corner at any given moment?
Hey, I'll take any baseball, but I mean, there's always some part of you that pines from the sport you grew up with. I'm sure that in 50 years, when there's players with replaceable cyborg parts, they'll be complaining about old men like me talking about all flesh and blood humans. I do think that the game as it is, it comes down to what the rules are. And right now, the rules in baseball kind of prioritize this thing. If you had, say, roster rules that limited, say, pitching staffs to 10 pitchers or something extreme like that, or changed the mound or a number of things, you change how the game is played. You see teams play very similarly in baseball, because it's the most effective way. And teams have a lot of money riding on it, and they have a lot of money riding on their pitchers. So, I mean, I do like that from an aesthetic standpoint, but it's hard to complain about a team doing what they think is best.
All right, last one. Quickly, before we let you go, prediction. World Series, who you got?
I'm boring, so I'm just taking the Dodgers. I think they're the better team. And in the World Series, I tend to pick the better team. Even if Kershaw stinks, they do have other pitchers.
Yeah, well said, well said. Thoroughly enjoyed the time. Dan Zimborski, check him out on Fangraphs, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
There he goes. Obviously, so much to get into with the World Series there. We're all going to be focused on Kershaw, but man, I find myself blown away at exactly what we were kind of talking about with him there. Just the depth of this Dodgers lineup. I mean, they're obviously the massive favorites over the Rays. I mean, it just feels like there's only one good outcome for baseball in this. Like that's the other question I find myself. I think we all agree it'd be the better outcome for baseball for the Dodgers to win. But can you talk yourself into a world where it's actually better? And I just realized who I'm asking this question. No. So, no, of course you can't talk yourself into a world where the Rays winning is better.
No, the Rays are, like I've said multiple times on the radio over the past multiple weeks, and I will reiterate it. They are my least favorite franchise in all of professional sports. I just hate what they've done. I just, you know, like I said, like I was tweeting about, I was watching that game on, was that Saturday night when they were playing Game 7, right, against the Astros? And, you know, Charlie Morton is cooking the Astros. Like, the Astros are helpless against him. I think it was in the sixth inning, he was shutting them down. And he gets a couple guys on base, an old, you know, monster nerd, Kevin Cash, comes walking out of the bullpen looking for 66 pitches, zero runs, you're stud. And it's like, better pull him, he let a couple guys on base. It's just like, baseball is just so, like, I don't know, it's just so matchup driven, and that's the problem with this, with the pace these days, is because all these matchups are so huge to every single one of these relievers that come in there, right? There's no feel for the game. All these guys come in there and it's their biggest outing they've ever had in their lives, and they're grinding out these pitches, and that's the reason it takes so long, is because there's so many pitching changes, and all these guys mean so much to these guys. So I can't stand the Rays. I can't stand what they stand for. I know that the Dodgers are much more analytically inclined. I know they love analytics. I know that's a big part of what they do. But they don't stink of it like the Rays do to me. I feel like at least the Dodgers spend big bucks and they have stars and they sign guys and they're willing to retain superstars. Unlike the Rays, who, you know, suck away their prime and then trade them away when they're due for a contract. You know, and then they just start the whole cycle over again. They suppress the salaries. If the Rays win this, it's just such an indictment for baseball for me. And then it'll just be like, everyone will be doing openers and, you know, everyone will be doing 100 pitching changes a game. And pitchers will only be going 5 innings and 26 pitches because, you know, oh, it's a better matchup. Oh, what's the spin rate? It's like, oh, whatever happened to the starter going 8? Like, ugh. I sound like such a Neanderthal, but I don't care. I just don't care.
No, stand by those thoughts, because they're all right and true. Honestly, like, I think the thing is like, we've all watched baseball teams with bad 4 or 5 starters, sometimes bad 3 starters, sometimes 2. Sometimes you'd love a number 1. There's been plenty of teams with that. And I think we can understand a world where you don't love your 4 and 5 guys. And OK, let's try to patch together a bullpen day, or let's go with the opener or whatever. But for me, I still hate the idea of, like you said, your stud, your ace, your front of the line guy, and you're just saying, well, 70 pitches, that's enough for you. I can't stand it. And then you talk about how the Dodgers are just really like a supercharged, sexier version of the Rays. It's almost like, and I'm sure our producer, Sho Ali, is going to love this, it's like it's the same movie. One's just the indie version, and the Dodgers are the blockbuster. It's like they're the ensemble cast. It's like they've got everybody in there. That's kind of the difference between the two of them. Yeah, it's a good analogy. I know. Just click to me like that. So, I mean, I'm right there with you. I don't want to see the Rays win this thing either, because I don't want to say I worry for what it'll mean for baseball, because, look, teams at the bottom end of the payroll, they're going to mimic the Rays whether they win this series or not. But I think if the Dodgers are able to do it, it does maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, push teams into the idea of you got to spend to win, because I think we're all sick and tired of seeing the kind of salary depression, the slow free agency years. Like, obviously, we know with the pandemic and everything, maybe it's a little different this year, but I think we're all sick and tired of seeing that kind of salary depression in baseball, for sure.
And I think there's another very exciting storyline heading into this World Series, and it's probably the likely Game 2 starter for the LA Dodgers. how tight are Walker Buehler's pants going to be on Wednesday night? Because, and if they win, please, God, let that guy go back on the Zoom chat and ask about the pants. We need the answers about his pants.
Mike.
Because, boy, oh boy, Mike. If Mike, if they win and he has those same pants on and we don't get the question, I will be extremely disappointed. So, yeah, I'm really excited for the World Series to start, and I can't stop thinking about Walker Buehler's pants.
Buehler's out there looking like stupid sexy Flanders from The Simpsons in his skiing outfit. That's exactly what I think of. And just to add to your point, I hope they also, Blake Snell getting the ball in game two, I hope they ask him about it as well. Like, so Blake, Walker's pants were tight. That, like, them asking Max Fried about that in the CS, that was incredible. It broke his brain. He did not know what to do. Why are you asking me about this man's pants? I really hope we get some more of that.
And when I tweeted out the picture of his pants and I said, I'm sorry, these pants are far too tight, our great colleague from Sportsnet, Christina Rutherford, one of the best writers in the country, she tweeted me and said, I respectfully disagree. And I thought, you know what? That was bad of me, because I didn't even think of our opposite sex sports fan, our female sports fan, who, that's great for them. I mean, that guy's obviously great bod, chiseled, and he just gets to show it off with those pants. So, you know what? I wasn't thinking of our female sports fan, and that was my bad. They weren't too tight. They were just, they look good out there. Little added bonus when you get to watch a sick baseball team and get a guy with the tight pants.
Tight pants talk heading into the World Series. There are other storylines, but really all we want to know, how tight will the pants be and will Kershaw choke? That's really all we... Sorry?
I feel like we sleep on Dustin May, too, because Dustin May's pants, they're pretty tight, too, and that guy's got that string bean body. His legs look like they're 10 feet long. His pants are tight, too.
That guy's an all-team first great look guy out there. He's got the red hair. It's flowing behind him. He's looking like a lion. It's a mane. That guy's, his aesthetic is exceptional out there.
And I will say, just something that I wanted to bring up in our opening block, and I completely forgot. And I'm glad that we have a little bit of time here. Baseball is, I'm so happy that it seems that we're past the show-up stage of baseball. Because Justin, we were talking about Dustin May, and after he got that the double play ball, and then he struck out Ozzy Albies, I believe it was, with 101 mile an hour heat at the top of the zone. Huge Sally, pumping his glove, every at bat, sick bat flips, the whole bench is erupting, they're all celebrating, nobody's throwing at each other, everybody's really happy and really excited, and I feel like it's like that usually in playoff baseball, but I feel like it's been way better this run. I feel like the celebrations and everything, and we've all gotten past the like stupid code of baseball, and I feel like it's sick. I feel like the boys are way more pumped up than they've ever been. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all. I've loved to see it too. And honestly, just a working theory. I don't know. I'm just thinking here. I genuinely wonder if all of baseball just like funneled all their hatred into the Houston Astros and they had no room to yell at Fernando Tatis and that was it. And it's like after you didn't yell at Tatis, they had nowhere to go. They can't start getting retroactively mad at all this stuff. Because, if we're going to talk about Dustin May and him celebrating, Bellinger, after he proved us both very wrong, as we mentioned in the opening block of the show, there was no bat flip there. It was a majestic bat drop and a strut to first. It was incredible. Like, it was so good, so fun to see, and honestly, I can't wait. I think we both kind of expect the Dodgers. I know you are, fingers crossed, hoping it's the Dodgers. Your dream scenario is Kershaw blows it, Dodgers battle back to win in extras or something. Would that be like the perfect scenario for you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm hoping it goes seven. I hope that the Dodgers lose 1-4 and 7. Oh no, the Dodgers lose 1-4.
Oh, whoa,
and then in game seven, Kershaw gives up like 4 or 5 in the first, and they come back and win 6-5 in dramatic fashion. When your boy, Mookie Betts, hits a walk-off home run to win the World Series, and he gets to home plate, and he'd be like, I'd like to thank the Boston Red Sox for trading me, because Boston Red Sox stink, and the Dodgers are sick. That's what I hope. That's what I hope happens.
Well, I would love nothing more than to see Mookie Betts win the World Series. He's doing it in the wrong jersey. And, yeah, we're not going to get my blood pressure up at this point in time. So you know what? we're actually going to do something to bring me down, to calm me down. We talked about great aesthetics in baseball in the World Series. There may be a great aesthetic coming to the NHL whenever games return. Ooh. We're going to tell you what that is when we continue on Sportsnet tonight. Listening to Sportsnet tonight on a Monday, it's usually Brent Gunning, that's me, and Sam McKee, my co-host here. There's a couple tent poles of this program. We're going to try to shoehorn golf into it. We haven't done that today. I don't know that we will. And another tent pole belief of this program is, boy, we love to talk about sports, jerseys, sweaters, uniforms, whatever you want to call them. And we got a tease of a retro throwback in the NHL, the Avalanche tweeting out, Instagramming out, it's on some form of social media, a pair of blue and white Nathan MacKinnon gloves that, boy, they certainly look like they would go with a Nordiques throwback. So I think we might be getting a Nordiques throwback from the Avalanche whenever the NHL returns. McKee, you love a good old-school jersey. You love some good sweater talk. What do you think of the Nordiques sweaters?
Not a Nordiques sweater guy, I have to admit to you. I just thought that, you know, there's a balance between sort of the nostalgia versus actually nice sort of thing, you know. Like I think you know, you look at the Raptors purple jerseys, the ones that they've kind of thrown back to, and I think there's an argument to be made that that's actually a horrifically ugly jersey. I really do, but we all love it because it's nostalgia. It's a nostalgic jersey from the first year of their existence, from the first 2 years, so we kind of love it. I think the Nordiques jersey is just ugly. I don't know. I think it's a bad color of blue. I don't like the fleur-de-lis. I kind of hate the logo. I'm just not a Nordiques jersey guy. I just, of all the old school jerseys, I think that one is one of the worst ones. Is that a hot take?
No, I don't think it's that hot. One, I think because of the part of the country we're talking in, I don't think there's a ton of people who just, oh, the good old days of the Nordiques and the fleur-de-lis. Yeah, I don't know that that's the most popular of opinion here in southwestern Ontario. I do have to say, I love something about the kind of like paler color of blue. We really don't see that anymore. It's kind of similarly to how I felt about, you know, when the Hurricanes brought back the Whalers green. It's just like anytime you get a color that you just don't see. And I guess you could say the exact same thing about the Raptors purples. It's just kind of nice to get a new color in the mix. We're going to get that when Seattle comes in a couple of years. I think that's the one reason why I think I'm okay with it, is because it's just adding something new to the color palette. The Seattle Kraken, I'm going to call them by their actual name here on the home of the NHL. You hear us. You can watch those games on.
No.
I got to say, I love the logo, and I think the jerseys look good, but if you just showed me the color palette, I would have told you it was atrocious and ugly, because I hate that kind of that soft, weak teal, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the best unis. I like the actual sort of the arms of it, but I hate how every sort of team has gone to the one stripe at the bottom look. I'm not a fan of that look, and I think the Kraken, I mean, oh, wow, I called them by the wrong name. I think the Squid jerseys, they'll be popular for a while, but, I mean, it's kind of like the newer teams that have come in. I like the Golden Knights, but, you know, you'll get sick of them quickly. The Jets are due for a revamped jersey. Theirs are kind of getting stale. So, I mean, if we're looking at the old school jerseys, like of the Nordique era, I mean, I'm really partial to the Kings of that era. You know, like that purple. Oh, I love that.
The yellow one.
Oh yeah, like I prefer those ones. Like I don't know. I'm just not a big Quebec Nordique guy. You know.
No, here. Again, like I said, very, very fair take to have. Now, if you're kind of talking about, you mentioned those old school Kings unis, whether they're the purple ones with the crown or the yellow ones. Justin Bourne, he was digging through some old jerseys.
Oh,
he was tweeting out some of those the other week. Great follow there. So of course, we're going to talk about uniforms. I'm going to have to mention it. We've talked about the Leafs a lot tonight. I've been banging this hobby horse for a while. I'm going to continue to do so. I need the Leafs to retro the Sundin era blue on the shoulders, crinkle leaf with the tie. I need it more than I need air to breathe. If I see Joe Thornton and Austin Matthews and Zach Hyman cruising around in that jersey, I will be 12 years old.
Zach Hyman. Zach Hyman. Of course, you threw that in there. And they're in the new Zach Hyman, Joey Anderson. You're going to have to – that's his name, right? The guy they traded for? That's his name, Joey
that
Anderson?
That is his name, yes.
Yeah, okay, good. You're going to have to hitch your wagon to him because everybody says that he's the new Zach Hyman. So I'm fired up about that.
I was just going to say, there were two things I saw about new Leafs this offseason that just brought a smile to my heart. And one was Joey Anderson. I don't even know if he means it. I don't know if he believes it. Just saying exactly what he needs to say to get in the good graces of everyone of, I just want to be like Zach Hyman. That's all I want to do. I just want to channel that guy and become him. Yeah, I'd say we could take some more of those. And then Joe Thornton also, when he's talking about all the guys he loves on the team, talked about Freddie Anderson was a big reason why he signed here, and Tavares and Matthews and Marner. He included Zach Hyman in the list of guys that made him want to come here and be a Leaf. So, definitely enjoyed that.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. And I wanted to quickly, before we head off here, quickly wanted to mention that with you. I thought that was interesting that he brought up Freddie like that. Do you think that's him being a vet and just understanding that goalies need that confidence building? Or what do you think that was? Because I thought that was, I mean, Freddie Anderson's a great goalie, and maybe he's just used to watching Martin Jones have six pumped past him every night, but I thought that was interesting that he brought up Freddie.
I think it's a lot more about Martin Jones than people would like to believe. I think we think of Joe Thornton as this class guy and team, and look, he's not those things, but he also loves to throw a shot, I would think. And yeah, he's had a terrible goalie on his side. Another thing, I went back and looked up the numbers against the Sharks. Freddie Anderson, I think there's only eight teams he has a better save percentage against in his career. He's .924 against the Sharks. Obviously, Joe would have seen a lot of them when he was in Anaheim there as well. So I think part of it is what you're saying, that hey, new guy, gotta pump the tires, gotta have him feel good about himself. But I also just think they played in the same division for a while, and you know, Thornton would have seen him, I guess, four or five times a year. So that's another reason why I think that happened. But yeah, it definitely piqued my ears that Thornton was the first guy he singled out of all of them.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good too. And I just love seeing him talk and hearing him talk. And I thought that point that Dave McCarthy brought up was pretty interesting about how he definitely, having him on the team, having Wayne Simmonds on the team, having Bogosian on the team, having these veteran guys is certainly going to take off some of the media pressure. You know, I, for one, like, I mean, I do, when I'm producing the Leafs games and we're at the rink, I go down and I do an intermission interview. I'd ask a couple questions, you know, always extremely hard-hitting stuff. I mean,
Big J Journal.
Yeah, but it's going to be pretty interesting. I mean, when we get to go to a game, if we get to go to the games this year, or if I'm sure there won't be intermission interviews, but it would be really cool to be able to say, hey, yeah, Steve Keogh, I'd like to talk to Joe Thornton at the interview. Like, there's definitely some compelling guys that are really good with the media that would be really fun to talk to. So I'm the older guys have always been the best. Like, talking to Jason Spezza was always the best. Marleau was always the best. Tavares was the best. You know why? Because these guys have done 1,000, and it's a business transaction, baby. Bing, bing. Bing, bing, and then you're out of there. So I love the older guys talking to the media because they know how to do it. They know what to say, and they know how to sort of elevate their teammates without throwing anyone under the bus.
Yeah, that jumped out to me as well, because I think back to, I remember I used to cover the odd Leafs practice. They'd send me down there with the Sportsnet camera crew, and I remember, so this would have been when Connor Brown was still here, so this would have been the before the regular season opener of his last year as a Leaf, and I remember looking around the room, and Connor Brown's the guy I'm talking to after a Leafs practice. So yeah,
gracious.
I think the names have gotten a little bit loftier here, and yes, hey, Connor Brown, extremely, extremely gracious.
I talked to him a couple times during the interview, during the intermissions, and always super gracious with his time. So Connor Brown, love being a Leaf, good Ontario boy.
Oh.
There you go. Happy he's doing well in Ottawa.
Yeah, I've seen some numbers getting floated around for him. Feels like he might be getting a payday. I didn't know the Sens were even allowed or willing to do that. But hey, good for him. I always say, I don't know if this is still the case because Tavares is here and Marner's here and Thornton's come in and all these guys. I don't know that anyone loved being a Leaf more than Connor Brown did in his tenure here. I genuinely don't know that it meant.
And he got one of the biggest goals in this sort of franchise, this iteration of the Leafs, you know, history. You know, that was sort of a turning point goal, turning point game. There was always, they didn't know if they were going to make the playoffs, and you know, the little leprechaun found his pot of gold or whatever Bonesy said. So I love that goal.
Yeah.
And then it set up Curtis McElhinney to make that sick pad stop on Crosby. All the good old days, you know, when we didn't have expectations for this team, eh, Gunner? Weren't those days fun?
Oh, man, that takes me back. Hey, free plug. I was at Hurricanes down on Brewer Street there, and they had Bonesy blaring. Holy Mackinac, holy McElhinney, the Leafs are going to the playoffs. The tragedy hit played, and we poured out onto Brewer Street. Oh, simpler times. Gord Downie was even with us then. But obviously, tremendous
Gord
stuff lies ahead for the Leafs. We'll see. That is that true?
I saw hockey-esque Dave Bedini, who is a marginal beer league goalie. I've played against him a few times in the city's West End here. But he tweeted out that that Joe Thornton was Gord Downie's favorite hockey player of all time.
Yes, I did see this.
And they signed him on the day before the anniversary of his death. So I thought that was cool. I thought that was pretty cool. You know, if my hoser heart loved that. So I know we got to go, but I just want to quickly mention that before we hit the break.
I'm happy you did, because I had it as a topic I wanted to give my due. 3 years ago this weekend, we lost, Canada's unofficial poet laureate. If he means a lot to you, hopefully you got to listen to some tunes. And even if he doesn't, please check them out, because that guy's as big a slice as Canadiana as you could possibly get. But we will move along so I don't cry. On the radio, Kyle Glazer, a national Major League Baseball writer with Baseball America. He's going to join us next. We're going to talk a little bit of baseball when we continue. Yes, dive back into the World Series, Chokergate, Kershaw, all that and more when we continue on Sportsnet tonight.
Stargazing doesn't have to be boring. Not when you study sports stars. This is Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So cards on the table. I lied. Throw into the last break. We're actually going to talk a little hockey with Ryan Dixon. I'm very excited about that. We love the World Series. Probably talk a little bit about that with him as well. We'll dive back into that in the 10 o'clock hour. We'll be here until 11. Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me, waiting dutifully on the line. Joining us right now, Ryan Dixon, NHL on Sportsnet. How you doing, Dixie?
Doing well, guys. How are you?
Doing great.
Doing well. So there's been a lot of free agency moves. There's been a lot of that. We'll dive into that. Some guy with a beard signed with the Leafs. There's lots to talk about there. I want to go backwards a little bit, and it's an idea both of us love. I really love it because it's mine. Now, there was some talk about an all-Canadian division being bandied about in the NHL. Maybe we're going to get that this year. Now, that led me to get on my soapbox and pound the drum like I love to. Why, Ryan Dixon, and maybe your answer is there's no good answer. Why does the NHL, once Seattle comes in, not have a quadruple header of Canadian games on Canadian Thanksgiving so I have something to distract me from my family?
Yes, please, anything. Give me anything. Yes, I was all over that tweet, Gunny, when I saw that, because I think, I don't know if it was, I guess it would have been a year ago when the last season started or the one before, that I kind of had that epiphany, and I was, I had it as a note in my weekend takeaways that, you know, obviously the model here is the NFL and American Thanksgiving, and I'd have to look at the schedule. I mean, there might be times where I have to believe the NHL always starts before Canadian Thanksgiving, right? Like, I don't think the calendar would ever line up such that it would pass before the league would start. So, I mean, it just feels like such an amazing way to kick off some early season excitement. So you've got the Monday is the day we're talking about, and you could have a slate of games throughout. And, I mean, I imagine you would make them as part of a back-to-backs, you know, Saturday in Montreal, a return game Monday in Toronto, things of that nature, Edmonton, Calgary. I don't know. It's just, it's right there. And when I saw your tweet the other day about that, I was like, yes. Why are we not talking more about this? Because it just feels like a slam dunk.
All right, Dixie, now to move on to another excellent idea, which isn't mine, but one that's been bandied about and maybe was exposed by Bill Foley with a little slip of the tongue. But this talk of an all-Canadian division due to COVID restrictions has got me a little hot and bothered here. I'm pretty excited about this. I dream of a world here where every Saturday night for the hockey season, we have a doubleheader of Toronto, Montreal, Calgary, Edmonton. Now, tell me why this won't work, or if you don't want to do that, tell me why it's the best idea ever.
Well, I mean, they may have no choice, right? Like, there's obviously the hand is being forced here. So let's just go with it's going to happen. It's like the Canadian original six, basically, right? Like, there's so much opportunity here. I mean, obviously, there's existing rivalries, but you can kind of stir some new ones up, too. I don't know if we can get a little bad blood going between Ottawa and the Jets, maybe. Who knows? But I think all Canadians' ears perked up a little bit at that, if, in fact, this is what comes to pass and that the seven teams have to play an all-Canadian schedule. I mean, we haven't had a Montreal-Toronto series for so long, since the late 70s. We haven't had an Oilers-Flames series for so long. I mean, this still wouldn't quite reach that level, but to have them play, you know, so frequently, I have to believe it would be mad intensity. And yeah, like, it definitely seems like, as you said, it was a slip of the tongue from Foley, but it sure seems like it's being viewed as a possible solution to travel restrictions. And I mean, why not? I don't really see the drawback. I mean, I don't know what the rest of the league is going to look like, if, you know, how things are going to get divvied up. Obviously, we all expect that there's a very good chance teams in the U.S. and Canada will be playing a more regional schedule, but let's do it, man. I mean, could you imagine, like you said, every Saturday night you've got Habs, Leafs, and you know, Oilers, Flames going in the late tilt? It'd be unbelievable.
Yeah, but the only caveat to that is if the Canucks are involved, they have to play at 4 p.m. their time. It's just a rule.
Yes.
I don't make them. They have to do it. Now let's say hypothetically we do get this, and I don't even know how hypothetical it is. It feels like a very real possibility. How would you kind of handicap that division? Like, who is the top Canadian team? I think there are a lot of ways to make a lot of cases for plenty of different teams here, but where are you at? Who would you look at as the favorite in a all-Canadian division?
Let me filibuster here a little bit while I think about it and say, like, we're all used to talking about the Canadian teams in the context of no one's won the Cup since 93. And I know it's a tough sell right now because no one's really come close in the last little while, but you do look around at each burg and, like, there is reason for hope pretty much everywhere. I mean, it's hard, I guess, not to say Vancouver coming out of the playoffs, and I do like how, I mean, they're 1-2 of Pettersson and Horvat. I mean, Horvat as the number two at a much more palatable number obviously allows you to do some things with the rest of your roster. I mean, there are questions on the defense, and now Markstrom's gone. So it could be okay, but, you know, we'll see what Demko and Holtby can do. I mean, Edmonton, I remember at this when return to play came, there was part of me that was like, just pick the Oilers. No one knows anything. It's this crazy best of five. But when you start with Draisaitl and McDavid, you know, why not? Like, at some point, those two are just going to rip through the league or rip through the playoffs. And I like what Ken Holland's done there. I won't go through every single squad, but I think the Leafs obviously have to be the next one mentioned. I mean, this probably does come down to right now a battle between Toronto and Vancouver. I do like what the Leafs have done to fill out the roster. And I guess just because, I mean, I think a Demko-Holtby tandem can work, but maybe just with the stability the Leafs have, knowing Freddie Anderson is coming back, knowing he has a good backup to start the season for the first time in a while. I mean, you look at the talent on the Leafs at the top end, and they continue to play with the fringes, and Dubas is, you know, pretty on the record, I think, at this point about kind of following the model of a team in their actual division, Tampa Bay, of trying to get bigger and stronger. I guess I would pick the Leafs as the preseason favorite, but I mean, like, even Ottawa, with everything that's gone on there and the craziness at the top, I understand there's, for that reason, there's a sense of despair sometimes from Sens fans, but my God, they've got so many good young players now and prospects coming into that organization. If Winnipeg can retool its defense, I mean, they still have a great infrastructure there. And Markstrom went to Calgary. So, you know, I mean, I'm not saying all of these teams would have a shot at winning the Stanley Cup next year, but if you want to kind of twist things around a little bit and if you really give it some thought, like, man, there is a case for either short or slightly longer term optimism in pretty much every Canadian city.
It's true. And I guess we'll go back to the Leafs there, and you're mentioning what they've done with the sort of bottom half of their roster. And we were just talking about it with Dave McCarthy off the top of the show, and we were talking about how I commend Dubas for what he's done, and I really, really didn't think that this was part of his plan. I didn't really think that he was going to waver off of his game plan. I think in a pretty extreme way. I mean, you have to kind of call it as it is. It's the bottom half of the lineup certainly looks a hell of a lot different than it did last year and in the certain shortened five-game series. But I guess the question I have is, do you think this sort of shift in philosophy is the right one and it's going to work?
You know what? I don't want to say resistant, but, you know, we kept having this conversation about playoff hockey still being different. And I mean, the move to speed and skill in just basic terms happened so, what feels to me like, so rapidly in the league and I guess within the Leafs as well. But, man, it's hard to deny it when you look at the tweaks that Tampa made that ultimately did make the difference. The St. Louis Blues the year before that, I mean, it goes without saying these are talented teams. Washington as well, but they have size. They have strength. And, you know, it's I mean, the thing with Kyle Dubas is, you're right, we all kind of thought, or maybe it was our mistake in thinking he was a bit of a fundamentalist when it came to, you know, I think you were tweeting at the draft, Sam. Like, they still love their 5'9", you know.
Oh, I was tweeting at the draft.
Guys. Yeah, like, he's clearly still, it's not like he's abandoned skill, but, you know, I don't think, like I said, I think our issue was thinking of him as someone who's a slave to skill as opposed to the fact that what he really is someone who's always looking for an advantage or, you know, looking to evolve, always thinking, right? The guy is always thinking. And I think all of these people who have come into the different sports at such a young age, I mean, their calling card is they're open to anything, right? Yes, they have strong core beliefs about how things should be done or mistakes of the past, but I think, you know, they're young people, and by, you know, in general, young people tend to be a little more flexible. And I just think it's become somewhat undeniable for him as he looked around that and the results of his team that something had to change. And, you know, Wayne Simmonds is a tough guy, but they're going to count on him to score some goals. Joe Thornton certainly, you know, adds a big, heavy body, but I mean, his calling card is still going to be that guy can still pass about as well as anyone out there. Certainly from a stationary position on the power play anyway. So, you know, clearly it's not like they've gone out and, you know, got big, heavy lunkheads. I mean, they're obviously still very much looking for guys who can play, but you're right. The complexion of that bottom six has changed quite a bit this summer. And I think that is, you know, no doubt a response to what he's seen with his team and what the results have been at the very top of the league.
Talking to Ryan Dixon here on Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me. So I think we all know Brody of the new guys is going to be the biggest kind of dividend, the biggest positive. He'll make the most difference. But outside of him, you know, which of those kind of guys that the Leafs added, be it Jimmy Vesey, be it Thornton, be it Simmonds, do you think will have the biggest impact this year? And, you know, let's try to remove the Joe Thornton leadership part from the equation, because I honestly don't know. I don't know how we can quantify that. I think we all believe it's going to help, but I don't know how you quantify that. So in terms of just kind of on ice, maybe production, outside of Brody, of the new guys, who do you expect to have kind of the biggest role with this team?
I think it will be Thornton. I mean, I still think this guy can play. Obviously, he's, you know, he's coming here because he really sees a chance for the team to win the cup. Like I said, that big body, you know, it's not necessarily about running defensemen through the glass. It's just about being a big, strong guy. And he still brings that. I mean, Simmonds in front of the net is, you know, if he can get back to, you know, not his best days, but I mean, he's a guy who could certainly get some greasy goals, but I do think Thornton has the potential to even move up in the lineup a bit and be, you know, squeeze up into that third line. And I just see him as a guy who can still probably go out there and get 55 points. Like you said, it's tough to quantify, but I think we all know Big Joe brings a certain looseness that I think a team that plays under such a microscope, a team that's getting to that point in its journey where everyone's grinding their teeth a little, I do think that can help. So you're right. I mean, obviously, Brody's a guy they're looking at to play on the first pair. That's going to be tops among their acquisitions, but I really do think Thornton can help this team.
Yeah, and Ryan, I tweeted this out when they announced the signing, but yeah, Showers in Toronto just got a little more interesting too, with Jumbo Joe in the fold.
Absolutely. Hey, this guy can help the team everywhere, Sam. Everywhere.
Yeah, I love it.
That's right. On the ice, off the ice, apparently in the shower. Who knew? Ryan Dixon, thank you so much. And we like you so much. We're not even going to make fun of the Habs giving a lot of money to fringy players or
Mookie
Betts. Red Sox trading Mookie Betts. Yeah, that one's tough for me too, buddy. So we can commiserate on that while we're enjoying a quadruple header of NHL games on Canadian Thanksgiving one of these years. Ryan, thanks so much for the time tonight, bud.
All right, Josh Anderson, next great power forward. I'll see you guys.
See ya.
Oh, he had to get it in. I mean, hey, we do, both of us do like Josh Anderson.
I think, will say.
Term and money is a little questionable, but yeah, we both love that player.
I have a couple of things to say quickly, because I want to talk about Joe Thornton on the power play, who we're going to hear from in our next segment, who had a great interview today with Tim and Sid. I heard it was excellent, and we'll replay it for you the next segment. But Josh Anderson, I'm not going to hate. I cannot sit here and hate on the Habs for Josh Anderson, because I was on the front of the train saying bring Josh Anderson to Toronto. I love Josh Anderson's game. I think Josh Anderson is a rare type of guy that you know how you talk about having a take that goes against the grain, a zag. He's the zag player in the NHL these days. There aren't guys like him. I mean, he's the closest thing to Tom Wilson that there is in the league. And, you know, they gave him a similar contract to Tom Wilson, and people got their back up. Oh, they gave this much money to a guy who has one goal. He's going to be good. That is going to be what my prediction is. That's one of those contracts that we all made fun of. Hey, we all crucified. We killed the Washington Capitals for that contract for Tom Wilson when he signed it. And now it's like, I mean, you don't even think about that contract. You just think about how much of an impact player he is. And I really think that Josh Anderson has the ability to have the impact on the game that Tom Wilson does. So I didn't hate that trade. In fact, you know what? There's 1,000 Max Domis in the NHL these days. That Max Domis grow on trees. Guys that score, what, 45, 50 points, smallish kind of winger center types that kind of, you know, there's a ton of guys that do that. So I'm not really concerned about losing that. And I think that if you can acquire a guy like Josh Anderson that's harder to find, you got to lock him down. So I didn't hate that. But now...
You know what now hold on, because I have a quick thought on that as well.
Okay,
the difference between Tom Wilson and Josh Anderson is the forwards that surround those guys. Tom Wilson is able to be a much more effective offensive player and is actually able to impact the game in other ways other than running around and being a lunatic, which are all things I love. But because of the skill players around him, it makes him more effective. And I just worry that, you know, especially in that market, you're wondering, what are you paying for? And it's like, well, Jonathan Drouin's not exactly Nicholas Backstrom, who he's playing with at times, or Kuznetsov at times. So I just think that's going to be, it's not actually a difference in the player at all. It's just that you're going to see a massive difference in production, I feel like, and it has nothing to do with what Anderson brings. I just think it's one of those things where you get more out of that player when you have the elite offensive skill. But having said all that, I agree with everything you said in terms of the trade. You do that. That's fine. Max Domi is a fine offensive player in the league. And you know what? Their games are a little different. But if you want that, just go sign Mike Hoffman. He's out there. You could have him for free. Nobody wants him right now. Go get that guy. Now, you're in my head. Well, not for free in terms of money, but for free in terms of prospects or draft picks or anything like that. Now, get out of my head, because as he was talking about Joe Thornton and how good he's going to be on the, as Ryan Dixon was talking about how good Joe Thornton's going to be on that second power play, I had some questions about it as well. So where do you want to go with this? Because I have some thoughts on this Leaf second power play as well.
I don't want to talk about the second power play, Gunnar. I want to talk about the first power play unit. And I think...
Oh.
I really think that the players that the Leafs have signed in this offseason are, I like to make the sort of parallel in terms of basketball, they're perfect half-court offense guys. You know, you look at Joe Thornton, his transition game, let's not talk about that, because I don't think the transition game is, at this point of his career, is old Jumbo's strength. But you put him in the half-court offense, in the offensive zone, with guys with the finishing ability of Austin Matthews and John Tavares and Wee Willie Nylander, you put those guys together, I feel like those four with whoever you want at the top. I guess probably Morgan Riley is going to be back on the top power play unit now with the departure of, oh, I'm going to miss Tyson so bad on that top power play unit. Those, you know what? Those the equipment managers for the opposing teams, they'll have to stop replacing shin pads now that they come to Toronto, because they won't be bashing them off shin pads anymore. But anyways, I digress. I think that power play unit, if you go Morgan Riley at the top and you sort of have Joe Thornton working that left side half boards with you put Austin Matthews across the ice, John Tavares with as the bumper, and sort of Willie Nylander floating around the top. You have an unbelievable looking power play. And then it kind of bumps down Mitch Marner to the second unit, who can be the power play expert or sort of quarterback for that second unit that has Wayne Simmonds standing in front of the net, and you have other options, which I think it would give you two very different looks. So I like the idea of Joe Thornton not on PP2, but potentially on PP1. What do you think of that, Guyer?
I don't hate the idea, except for the fact that in order for Mitch Marner to be the million dollar player that he is supposed to be, he has to be on the power play and dominating at that facet of the game. He is a good offensive player. You talk about transition, that guy lives in it. But we saw how good he is at that. And now I am being counterintuitive to everything I always say about this team, because the thing that drives me nuts about this team for the past 2 to 3 years is that no matter what, just make sure life is easy for 16. It feels like that's always the goal. If Tavares is going, well, let's get 16 on his wing. If it's Matthews who's going, well, let's bump Marner up there and make sure he can play well. So I think that this team has at times tried to kind of make Marner the priority at times and where he goes. So that's the only thing about it that I do wonder. Now, I wonder if there's a world where you could kind of get the best of both worlds and you actually move John Tavares up into the old Nazem Kadri spot in the high slot, and you put Joe in the kind of bumper position. Great hands. He could feed whoever in the slot. Mm. You let Marner do his thing on the half wall, and then it gives you, because the problem with the Leafs power play right now is everyone in the world knows they want to get it to Marner and they'd like to swing it across the ice to Matthews. That's all they want to do. But if you put Thornton down there in that kind of bumper spot, I mean, that guy can sauce it from anywhere with the best of them, and then it just kind of makes the defense have to think a little bit more. So I don't have any problem with putting Thornton on that first power play unit. I don't think you can have a world where Mitch Marner's not on it. And look, if Mitch Marner got his Sebastian Aho deal or his $8 million or whatever it was, maybe you can do that with this guy. But if he's going to be a $10 million player, he has to eat on the power play for the type of guy he is.
Yeah, I guess I just have to watch him spin around at the top of the circle and fake a clapper and shoot it into some legs in front of the net. Can't wait for that. Can't wait to watch that all year again, you know? That's favorite thing to watch.
That's why you have the team's new dad. They've had a lot of dads going forward. Marlowe, the OG dad. Matt Martin was actually the OG dad. And now, well, I guess actually, I got to pay some respect. He's back with the Marlies now. Dickie Kloon is actually true OG dad of all things Leafs.
So it's funny, the Leafs acquired a couple guys that are so old. They acquired two no visor guys with Wayne Simmonds Joe Thornton. Two guys who don't even wear visors. That's how old the guys are acquiring. They got two grandfather rule guys on the team now. No visors.
That's phenomenal. I think we're both of the belief Ryan O'Reilly probably going to be the last guy playing in the show without one.
Hockey he's gonna fashion go for another 20 years. Superstar.
Yeah, he just that guy's meat and potatoes fashion. He's not walking the runways of Paris. That guy's putting on his boots and going to work with his fashion. That's right. I love it. Oh, some Blundstones. That's right. Grab the little tab at the back, pull them up. That's right. Love to do that. What else we love to do? We love to hear from Joe Thornton. And there's something about this interview that stuck out to me when I listened to it a little earlier today on Tim and Sid. We'll play the interview for you, and then I'll tell you what stuck out about it to me next when we continue Sportsnet tonight. Tim and Sid with a Hall of Famer edition of the program today. One soon to be one, Jerome Iginla, and one eventually one, Joe Thornton. Both joining the guys today. Not a bad job by their producers there. Plenty of them. Obviously, we want to get to hear from Joe Thornton now. He joined the guys earlier today. Here is the newest Maple Leaf.
Joe, it's great to talk to you. I'm always interested when people who haven't been Leafs for a while come into the Maple Leaf experience and have to do a lot more media than they've normally done. As a 41-year-old, like how is it was it alarming how much media you've had to do since making the move?
I think at 41, I've kind of seen it all. So it wasn't really a big shock to me.
Fair enough.
So it is, you know, it is what it is. And I'm just happy to do it.
We had a discussion on Friday when the news broke about whether this is an I'm going home move or this is my best chance to win a cup move. Like, how do you see the decision that you made?
Well, I probably, you know, 1%, you know, mom and dad being able to come and 99% hockey. I think this team, you know, it's a motivated group. It's a young, hungry group. And I think it, you know, has Stanley Cup potential. But, you know, really it's going to be day to day. We can't look at the outcome right now. We got to go day to day when this whole thing starts.
Joe Thornton here on Tim and Sid. Joe, February 24th of this year, which seems like 8 years ago, but that was the last proper trade deadline. Was there a feeling this might happen then? Well, obviously you said what you said to the media, and there was a feeling that you were yearning for another shot at the cup. Yeah. But were the Leafs now in hindsight, I think we're safe to talk about it. Were they close? Were they making a pitch from what you heard?
Well, I think honestly, I think since, you know, probably 2017, they've been, you know, seeing if I'd come to Toronto. So I don't think it's necessarily just the trade deadline. But I think it's been, you know, a few years now they've been, you know, knocking at the door, just seeing if I'd come. So it's just, to be here now, it's great.
You know, we're on across the country and there's a lot of fans outside of Toronto. There are a lot of non-Leaf fans who are just making sure that you realize that this group hasn't won a series yet. And it's been a few years in Toronto. Like, I know you keep saying, I have to represent the entire country here, Joe. Like, when you watch this team, do you feel like they're better than they've been able to accomplish thus far?
100%. Yeah. I realize what's been going on there in Toronto. I've been in the West Coast. We get to watch a lot of the early games. So I've watched a lot of their games over the past, you know, little while, and I know what's up, but, you know, I really truly believe, you know, this is a really good team, a lot of great pieces, great goaltending. It's going to be a fun experience, but it's a very deep team, and it's going to be exciting.
Joe, what will your role be? Because that was another part of this conversation Friday. We were all just kind of, forgive us, Joe, you were a bit of a talking point in this country on Friday. How do you see yourself after talking? I know it's initial. We don't even know when the next season's starting, but after talking to Kyle and Sheldon, how does Joe Thornton envision Joe Thornton's role on the Leafs?
Yeah, we'll just wait kind of and see in training camp, you know, where Sheldon puts me, to be honest with you. But I'm getting some games over here in Switzerland. It's been great. I played my first game the other night. You know, going to shake off some rust over here for the next month or how long it takes to get back there. But, you know, just help out as much as I can. And I talked to Patty Marleau. Patty Marleau said, great group of young players. They're, you know, willing to work, willing to listen. So just whatever they need, I'll be there for them.
What was the toughest part of leaving San Jose?
Well, it's been home for 15 years. You know, that's where my kids grew up. I got two kids, 10 and 7. So, you know, they're going to miss their buddies and their school there and things like that. And the fans have been so, so great to me. The organization's been great to me. So, you know, there's a lot of things I'm going to miss about it.
Joe Thornton here on Tim and Sid. What did Patrick Marleau tell you about what it's like being a Leaf?
Loved it. Yeah, he loved it. He said, first-class organization. They treat the players great. Anything you need, you know, they really look after their players. And, I almost went with him, like I said, a couple of years ago, and it just didn't transpire. But he had nothing but great words to say about the whole Leaf organization.
So it seems like you got some pretty impressive consigliere here. If you ever watch any mafia movies, you know, when you lean on someone for some input, the consigliere, you got Patty Marleau, and then we heard Joe Montana. Like, how did that come about? And how did Joe Montana help you make this decision?
I've met Joe, you know, a handful of times just being out in the Bay Area. And we have a really good mutual friend. And he said, hey, I was talking with this mutual friend about it. And he said, hey, you got to talk to Joe. And so, I gave Joe a call and we talked for about, you know, 20 minutes about him, you know, leaving the Bay Area and going to KC at the end of his career. And I was just picking his brain a little bit. And he was gracious enough to give me his opinion.
Joe Thornton here on Tim and Sid. How many years you got left, Joe? And I don't ask that in any disrespectful way at all. You are a unicorn. Like, how long do you want to do this?
As long as I can. I love the game. I truly love competing with the fellas. I like the fellowship. I love everything about hockey. But I've, you know, the last 5 years, I've really taken it day to day. And I think that's what's been driving me, is just, you know, I don't really see too far ahead. I just see day to day and just kind of keep it in a small window. And it's, you know, it's helped me along these years.
We're going to talk to Jerome McGinley later on in the show. And he just got the call for the Hall of Fame. And he did it without a cup.
Yeah.
Why is that final piece so important to you?
Well, when you're a young boy playing in, you know, in street hockey, this is the Stanley Cup. You know, that's why you play the game. It's the little kid in you that you still have at the age of 41. It's just, it's a big magical thing that I want to bring to Leaf Nation now.
Can you wrap your head around what that would be like?
No, but we're going to go day to day.
day to day. I hear you.
How cool it be for mom and dad, though? Like you said, I know you said earlier that this is a hockey decision.
Yeah.
But as you talk about the little boy and what it means to win a cup, I'm sure a little boy also means a lot for mom and dad to be down the road and be able to have dinners and things like that.
It's great for my kids. You know, they get to see grandma and grandpa all the time now. So it's great for them. But yeah, that, you know, like I said, it was 1%. You know, this is a hockey decision and a hockey decision only for me.
One of the most significant moments of your career happened in May when you shaved the beard. I think we can all agree on it.
Yeah. Forget the gold medals, whatever. Shave the beard. Yeah.
They're all on the list. Don't get me wrong. Gold medals. MVP. You know, they're all important. Yeah. They're all important. But the shaving the beard shook people to their core. Are you surprised at the emotional attachment people had to your beard? And will you, having shaved it and looking back on that moment, try and do it again because it's become a part of who Joe Thornton is?
Yeah, it was, I've grown it twice. I've had it big twice. So, there was a lot of mixed reviews on it. I think early on it was, you know, a nice strong brown beard. And then later on, it turned into a little bit of a tinge of gray. So,
were you ashamed it was gray? Like, is that why it also came off, or were you proud of it?
I think
you
should be proud. It's like a Richard. I thought I looked like Richard Gere a little bit. but yeah, I think my son really really likes it. So I'll probably get a little head start over here, growing it back again, I think.
Before we let you go, Joe, we appreciate the time from across the Atlantic. There's a lot of focus on the cup with you, obviously, because you've had such a good career, such a great career. We often don't talk about what you're most proud of. What, in the hockey world, what are you the most proud of in terms of the things you've accomplished?
Yeah, well, I think playing so long, I think that's, that's been – you know, a real blessing, me being healthy all these years. I think being part of the great Canadian teams that I've been a part of, some great moments in Vancouver, some great moments in Toronto over the years. But I think just the friendships I've had over the, 23 years, they're long lasting friendships. And, they always say these hockey guys are good guys, but really, over these last 72 hours, a lot of ex-teammates have called and texted, and the support they've shown me. It's a really great game with a lot of great guys in it.
Hey, listen, we understand it's getting pretty late over there in Switzerland, so we appreciate you taking the time, providing us with a wonderful backdrop for this interview as well.
Yeah. Lovely,
the curtains,
like a veteran in the game. Appreciate it, man. Best of luck in Davos, and when you get back here, hopefully we can have you in studio or do one of those things that we used to be able to do back in the day before this thing hit.
That'd be great. All right, you guys stay safe, eh?
You too.
Look at that. What a guy. Ending the interview with "You guys stay safe." There's Jumbo Joe Thornton on Tim and Sid. Couple things stuck out for me there. That we forget about how long that guy's been playing. We both had to, me and you, Sam, had to do a double take. Oh, yeah, he was, in fact, on the Vancouver team, because why wouldn't he have been? He's been that dominant for that long. And anybody who says he can't be a 3 or 4 C, well, just look back to 2010. Okay, maybe Olympic team is a little bit different there. Then the other thing that I want to point out, and I've heard this in a couple of interviews with Joe, you heard it in that one there. Everyone keeps pounding the drum of, oh, St. Thomas legend, you're finally back home and your parents are around and that's got to be great and back in your home province. And he is as nicely as he possibly can trying to tell everyone, yeah, that's great. My parents can call me on FaceTime. I'm here to win a cup, and that's why I'm here, because the Leafs can win the cup. Like, everyone keeps trying to pound home the hometown hero angle, and if the Leafs didn't have this roster, there is not a chance he'd be back here.
Bingo. You nailed it, Gunnar. Don't have a lot to add there. And I'm looking at the 2014 Team Canada. Forgot he didn't make that team. 2014, wow. Joe Thornton, how stacked is Team Canada? You know, I think there was probably one of the big discussions was that Chris Kunitz made that team and Joe Thornton didn't. I can't really remember the discussions, but I'm sure that was certainly one. And I'm just looking at this team. I mean, if we want to go back down that road, like, Matt Duchene was there. And, you know, Joe Thornton wasn't.
You know, hold on.
Do you want to retroactively have this take?
No, here's my thing. Matt Duchene, good little player. Everything's nice. I never understood for the life of me how he just got tabbed 13th forward on Team Canada for the rest of time. It feels like maybe that ship has sailed now, but for while there, go back to the World Cup of Hockey, it was just like Matt Duchene penciled in as the 13th forward because he can skate fast. Well, it's Hockey Canada, and boy, there are plenty of guys who can fly. So, yeah, I don't think it'll be old Duchene taking that spot anymore.
Buddy, did you remember? This is going to shock you, I think. Remember Dan Hamhuis was on the 2014 Team Canada?
Good stay at home, quiet D.
They love that. Mark Edward Vlasic. That team was legitimately, honestly, unbeatable. They scored, they had the puck the entire game and scored one goal, and then that was it. Like, they beat everybody 1-0.
And Babs loved it. He loved it.
Yeah, it was such a boring hockey tournament. Like, I actually was just like, oh, yeah, just like, well, just roll out the gold medal. This is so boring. And remember in the gold medal game, they dinged Backstrom the day before for, like, some weird steroids thing? Poor guy. I mean, we would have dusted him anyway, but still, that stunk for them. But, yeah. And then old Sid burying on and then, not to get too down on this, but in the gold medal game, everyone was pooping on Chris Kunitz for being on the team. Chris Kunitz, bar down in the third period to seal the victory for Team Canada. So there you go.
I've told you this before, but one of the many people, because the fan sent me to watch the game in Real Sports, I watched that game next to the late Rob Ford. So, hey, boy, wow. It all comes back to the Fords in Toronto.
Gold,
and that feels
gold.
Like a good... That's right. Hey, nobody would love this more than him. And that's all I'm going to say about him before I get myself in trouble. One thing I want to add about Joe Thornton before we step aside here. Has there ever been a bigger, you know, for lack of a better term, Ferda legend? He goes over to Switzerland, does not take a salary. On top of that, because he is a Swiss national because of his passport, doesn't even count as an import player for that team. I cannot imagine how beloved he is in Davos.
Honestly, can you imagine? Who's the head coach of Davos? Let's look that up.
That's a great question. Jeopardy
up.
Music. Well, you look up some guy who's like a third cousin of Ralph Kruger.
I just looked up Davos, and the first thing that came up was Davos Sweeney, so I don't think that's who it is. Anyways, can you imagine being the head coach of HC Davos, and you're like, oh yeah, we're going to run old Niederreiter, Jimmy Niederreiter out there, and, you know,
Hans Bergsonson.
David Ashenberger the second, and we're going to run all these boys out there, the Swiss Miss, you know, we're going to have a... And then it's like old Jumbo Joe Thornton, one of the best players in the history of the NHL, is like, yeah, sure, I'll play for free. And did you see they won their first game 9-2? I think Joe had a couple of helpers, 15 minutes of ice. Gotta love it.
Yeah, the only thing funnier than that to me is Jaromír Jágr playing for a team in the Czech Republic that made him their logo if he was a knight. And Jágr's at like borderline 50 years old. Last I checked, this was over a year ago, though, was near a point per game in that league. Can you imagine you are some 20-year-old kid playing in the Czech second division and it's Jaromír Jágr lined up alongside you?
Do you remember when during the lockout, when Joe Thornton was playing for Davos and they had the Spengler Cup?
And he played against Canada.
Yeah, him, Rick Nash, and Marty St. Louis were on HC Davos. Good luck. And the head coach of HC Davos is Christian Wolwend. So there you go.
He's now the assistant. I think Joe's the head coach there now. I'm pretty sure, at least, if not in title, at least in how all the guys look at him. So something we looked at, there's a big day coming up a couple of Saturdays from now. What should you do? How will you handle it? There's going to be a little bit of public policy talk on Sportsnet tonight when we continue. I got a question for you, Sam McKee. Are you a big Halloween guy? You like scary movies? You like dressing up? I feel like you love dressing up. But what are your thoughts on Halloween as a holiday?
I adore Halloween. I just, there's nothing that is better to me than a bunch of adults dressing like stupid things and just letting their inhibitions go to the wind, going to the bar. There's no holiday or day that ages better than Halloween, because it starts out when you're a kid and you get to get dressed up, you get to pick out your costume, and then you go trick-or-treating, get a pillowcase full of candy, you get gut rot, you get teeth rot, nothing better. And then as you move into your teenage years, you start to realize, ooh, this Orange Crush really goes well with Halloween. And then once you get into your 20s and college, it's incredible.
I was going to say,
of the best nights
my favorite one.
Some of the best nights I ever had in my life were Halloweens at college. Honestly, there was one night where I was dressed as Bruce Springsteen and things got wild. I won't go too deep into that one, but what a night that was. Barrie, Ontario, love you, hate you, all in one. And then as I got into this age, I don't like to get as wild as I did, but I still love getting dressed up, going to the bar, seeing creative costumes. It's great. And then once you get older, you have the joy of giving kids candy. So I feel like it's the thing that ages the best. But I mean, COVID is terrible and all the stuff that's happened in the world, the cancellation of everything. But man, I feel so bad for kids. Having Halloween being canceled is so terrible. But the worst thing is, like, I don't ever get political, Gunner. You know me. I don't get into any foray.
Genuinely scared of it.
I really never get into this. But this, I just felt like I needed to say something. Why are they creating so much gray area with this Halloween thing? They're like, it's recommended you don't go trick-or-treating. Either say you can go trick-or-treating or say you can't. So now you're creating this situation where you're putting it on these parents having to make this terrible decision where they tell their kid, who might not understand the gravity of the COVID situation, you have to be like, hey, buddy, you can't go out. He's like, well, my other friends at school are going. Why can't I go? So you're creating these terrible conversations that you have to have with your kids. Just cancel it. Cancel it or don't cancel it. Make it so that you have to chuck the candy. Find out who the real athletes are. The gray area they've created with this is so frustrating to me, and I feel bad for the kiddies who are going to lose out on Halloween. Sorry to get on my political soapbox, but I just had to bring it up.
Well, don't apologize, because I'm about to audition for a 680 News podcast here for half a second. I'll explain exactly why they won't just say that. Here's the thing. This is what you say. And if you've listened to me on this radio station at all, I'm sure you know exactly how I feel about the Fords. The thing about them throughout their entire tenure, when they were in city council to now he's the premier of this province, they only want to take credit for good. They do not want to be responsible for bad. It's the same reason him and John Tory have been pointing at each other saying, why won't you close the restaurants? And them going, why won't you close the restaurants? So they can just say, not me. I didn't close anything. I didn't take away your civil liberties. Unfortunately, that's the reason why. Nobody wants to be responsible for the bad news. They love to be there to hand out things or to cut a ribbon at a park or all that good stuff. Take credit for it? Yes, absolutely. But in terms of the taking responsibility, I said at the very beginning of this, and this is a slightly different tangent, but it all kind of comes together with it. It is easy to shut things down the first time because of COVID. Everyone gets it. Okay, we went into our bubble. I guess this was in April or whatever the case may be. Now when things are perking back up and things have been open, closing them again is a incredibly hard thing to do politically. I get why you wouldn't want to, but guess what? We talk about leadership in sports all the time. This is leadership in politics, is doing the thing when it's hard, not when it's easy.
For sure. That's extremely well said. Brett Gunnings, your daily podcast coming on the 680 News Podcast Network, our boy Ryan Clark, Fan 5 yes. Media alum, now producer extraordinaire, one of the hunkiest dudes in the business, went from a scrawny hired guy from interning to now a tall, strapping young man, best dressed guy in the building. So hopefully he hears this. I doubt he will. But anyways, love you, Ryan Clark. But I just you're
second,
just trying to
second best guy, dressed guest guy, JR Manitad. Yeah, for sure.
So they're just trying to please everyone with this decision. You know, it's like they don't want to be too left leaning. You know, they don't want to shut everything down, but they don't want to be too right leaning. So they don't want to have everything be wide open. So they're like, it's recommended. And it just puts parents in such a terrible position where they have to break it to little Jimmy that he can't go, but all his buddies are going. It's just so stupid. It's so stupid, Gunner. I know that there's such bigger problems in the world and like there's tons of other things to get upset about, but it really struck me today with how they're handling it. And you know what? The most upsetting part about all of this Halloween being canceled stuff and us not being able to go to bars, Halloween is on a freaking Saturday. It's on a Saturday, man. The best day for it to be on, because you get the Thursday, you get the Friday, and you get the Saturday. You get three full party nights of Halloween, three different bars, three different events, three different parties, three different outfits if you want. And I had the best Halloween costume this year. I'm not going to get to do it. I'm not even carving a pumpkin. Halloween's ruined. Thanks a lot, COVID. Brutal.
Do you want to tell us what the costume was?
Well, it's kind of niche. And it was okay. it would have been for like the 10 people who got it. But one of my favorite new artists is Orville Peck, and from Toronto. He's kind of like a new wave country musician guy, and he wears like a cowboy hat and he wears a mask that kind of like a frilly mask that goes down over his thing. He wears like a vest with no shirt underneath. So it would have been very cool. It would have been a great costume. The 10 people that got it would have loved it. So I'm all about having a niche costume for the people who love the thing, you know. One year I was Forrest Gump when he was running. I love a good Halloween costume. Halloween's the best. Anyway.
My back in college, I had a little bit of a keg, we'll call it. I still have one, but it was much more pronounced in my University of Windsor days. And it was every year, the entire house just pleading with me to go as Randy from Trailer Park Boys. Please, well, please, please. I never did it. Come on. Like, look, here's the thing. I'm in university. I have my lovely wife now. But before then, I cannot be going out as Randy on Halloween. You cannot do it.
So quickly before we go here. I was Ricky for like 5 straight years. I was Ricky, and I went to school for RTA in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, actually. And the day of Halloween, where Dartmouth, Nova Scotia is where Trailer Park Boys is filmed and where like they're from, and like that's like, and on the day of Halloween, it was a Saturday afternoon, and me and my cousin who lived out there together, we went out to run some errands. And I was like, I'm going to wear my Ricky costume when we go out and run errands. So I wore my Ricky Halloween costume, and I didn't get one comment from anyone because I just thought that that's how I was dressed. So I always love telling that story about Nova Scotia. So that's my last Halloween anecdote. And I'm sorry to anyone listening out there who has to tell their poor kid that they can't go trick-or-treating. I'm really sorry that you have to have that conversation. Anyways. We can go now, but just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, so am I, and I think I speak for Sam and I both when, hey, it's important to be safe in these times,
for
but
sure.
It's also important to find things you can do in a safe way. We've found that
Definitely.
With the game of golf. I hope some kids are able to find Ooh, it with trick-or-treating yeah. if you're outside of the hottest of spots. What else is going to bring us joy? Oh, that's the World Series. It's starting up tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can get into some more hot Clayton Kershaw. Is he a choker talk? How do the Rays starters match up against this lineup? World Series starts tomorrow. We will preview it next on Sportsnet Tonight.
Game night is the best night, and we're not talking rummy, canasta, or baccarat. All your games in one place. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Final hour here of Sportsnet Tonight. Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me at the top of the next hour. We'll give way to a kick in the grass. Dan Riccio and Jeff Blair will have you covered there. Yes, lots of hot supporter Shields talk. Whatever that is, they will talk about it.
25 seconds of Chelsea before we get to my 25
okay,
seconds of
okay.
Chelsea.
Okay, every Monday we got to do it. Yeah, yeah.
They return for the international break. Their offense going forward, they got to be one of the most dynamic teams in Europe, but boy oh boy, their defense and goaltending is horrific, and if they got any chance of being in the top four this year, they got to figure that out in a hurry. But boy oh boy, my boy Timo Werner, 2 goals and a helper, just firing it in the net, love him. So there you go, Chelsea, very exciting but terrible defensively. There we go.
It's a long 25 seconds. I'm happy it's over. You know what else I'm happy about? Kyle Glazer's here to not talk about soccer with us. He's here to tee up the World Series. Bringing him on right now. Very happy to have you on. National MLB writer with Baseball America. Kyle, how you doing tonight?
Doing all right. Thank you guys for having me.
All right, so look, we're not going to dance around the topic. We're not going to say, oh, there's actually plenty of other interesting things about this series. The most interesting thing about this series is what the Dodgers are going to get out of Clayton Kershaw. You know, what do you kind of expect from him? And then I guess a follow-up question to that is, what do you think is kind of the, and I don't know if this is even a fair question, but what's the floor of acceptable results for him? There's been so much talk about him being underwhelming in the playoffs. What do you think is kind of the least the Dodgers should hope to get out of this guy?
Realistically, 5 innings, 1 or 2 runs. He's a good pitcher. You'll remember in his NLCS start, he was actually doing okay and then just kind of was left in a little bit too long. Clayton Kershaw is still a very good pitcher. He's just not really the guy who can go 7-8 anymore. It's really 6 innings top, and against the best teams, you're better off giving him 5 innings, maybe 5 1/3, 5 2/3, depending where you are in the lineup. And he can still give that to you, 5 innings, 1 or 2 runs, keep you in the game. It's when they try and push him to give them more that he runs into trouble.
So the question I had for you, Kyle, and I know you write for Baseball America and you do lots of prospect stuff, and I'm sure you have a really well good understanding of sort of the Rays and the Dodgers organization, and I think they're both sort of the gold standard in terms of developing these arms that are just impact arms that are just sort of built for the baseball in 2020. And what do you think it's that these two teams do that really separate themselves, you know, from other franchises? Because these two teams, like I said, really are the gold standard for pitching prospects and hitting prospects for that matter, but their pitching really stands alone.
Yeah, so they've done it 2 different ways. The Dodgers, it's remarkably homegrown. Clayton Kershaw, homegrown. Tony Gonsolin, Dustin May, Walker Buehler, Julio Urias. All 5 of their starters were homegrown. The biggest thing with the Dodgers is they supply their minor leaguers with the best facilities, the highest quality food. So many of these teams kind of give their minor leaguers peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, throw them in these decrepit stadiums with weight facilities that wouldn't pass a lot of hygiene tests. I mean, they're just disgusting. And the Dodgers don't do that. They give these young players everything they need to really grow and become the best players they can be physically. And we see the rewards of that in the major leagues. The Rays, it's different. They actually have acquired most of their starting pitching through trades or signings. Blake Snell's homegrown, obviously. The Josh Fleming kid is homegrown, but Tyler Glasnow was a trade acquisition. Charlie Morton was a free agent signing. Ryan Yarbrough was a trade acquisition. What the Rays do really well is identify players in other organizations that they think they can make better with their coaching and player development. And more often than not, they're right.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that time and time again, and I'm just trying to recalibrate my brain here because you got talking about all the wonderful food the Dodgers prospects are eating, and now I'm thinking, we got tacos. What's going on here in that lovely L.A. atmosphere? So when you're the other thing I wonder about this Dodgers team is it feels like they are just, you know, a lot of it, as you said, is development, but it feels like they constantly, every couple of years, are just pounding out another guy who just helps lengthen the lineup. Like, I think about a guy like Muncy a few years ago for when he came up. For other teams, that would have been like the coming of a prospect that they had been waiting for all this time, and he's just another guy for the Dodgers. Is it just simply that development, or is there something kind of about the team in and of itself that allows them to just kind of continually lengthen their lineup without necessarily having to go out and add, you know, through trades or whatever it may be?
So what the Dodgers have a really good understanding of that a lot of other teams relate to the party to is power comes last. Find guys who have bat speed, who control the strike zone, who have quality at bats, who make hard contact. You can make adjustments to turn those line drives into home runs. It's when you start chasing power, you get into trouble. So guys like Chris Taylor, guys like Max Muncy, these were guys who hit for high averages, had high on-base percentages. Both Max Muncy and Chris Taylor got to the majors with other organizations. These were good players. The Dodgers just said, hey, just need to make a tweak. We'll access some more power in games and let that natural hitting ability flourish. And they picked up on it earlier than a lot of other teams, and as a result, they snagged some really good players at a very low cost.
So I got to ask you about Randy Arozarena, because I hate to brag about knowing something, because I had not heard of this guy really. Him dig in the three hole against the Toronto Blue Jays in the wild card round, and I had heard a little bit about him, but I didn't know much about him. And I got one look at him, and I said, okay, this guy's gonna kill the Blue Jays for the rest of my Blue Jays watching life, and he's gonna be one of their best hitters. But I didn't really expect this. I mean, where does this guy come from, and what can, like, I mean, what is this guy's ceiling? Is he going to be one of the better players in the league, or is this just sort of like a hot stretch?
Well, keep in mind, no one's going to hit 382 with a home run every other game over the course of a 162-game season. I mean, there will be a slowdown, but this is a really good player. And, you know, what I just talked about, power comes last. He'd been one of the top hitters in Cuba. We at Baseball America had him as one of the top 10 prospects in Cuba when he was there. He was a top 10 prospect in his international class. He was a top 10 prospect in the Cardinals system before they traded him. And it was a lot of the time because he could always hit. And he developed some more power this year, and all of a sudden, some of those doubles are turning into home runs, and he's just that much more of a threat offensively. Another good acquisition by the Rays, scouting someone in another system. But again, the same understanding that the Dodgers have. Hey, power comes last, find good hitters first, and you look at this guy's track record, he'd always hit everywhere he's been.
Yeah, he has, and I think the Rays would hope that continues. Now, one last one before I let you go. Are the Rays, if they're able to beat the Dodgers, is that good for baseball? I mean, my co-host has been banging the drum that, you know, this is not what you'd want to see in baseball. It's not what he likes. But could you make the case that it's actually good for the game? Like, what's the more, for baseball, who's the more compelling winner?
I think that people overplay that angle a lot. I'll say this, that if the Rays win with as tiny a payroll as they have, that will just give teams more reason to try and lower player salaries, which is something they're going to try and do anyway. So, again, baseball is a copycat league. But, you know, if the Dodgers win, you'd see other teams saying, oh, well, because we don't have the resources to compete with them rather than try and emulate them. Whereas if the Rays won, they'd say, oh, see, we can lower our payroll and compete anyway. I think for the most part, you know, whoever wins has got to tip your cap to them. And I think teams trying to emulate the Rays are going to fall short because – they have some really brilliant minds in there that allow them to do what they do. But at the same time, if they could have kept some of the players they've had, they would have kept them.
Yeah, it's almost like if the Rays had money, it's scary to think what they'd be. Oh, they'd probably be pretty similar to the Dodgers. Kyle, thoroughly enjoyed the chat with you tonight. Enjoy the World Series.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
There he goes, Kyle Glazier, national MLB writer, Baseball America. McKee, would you like to dump on the Rays one last time? Would you like to talk about your excitement for the World Series? Where are you at heading into this? I mean, we've talked a lot about Kershaw, and we're going to. Believe me, we will talk a lot about Kershaw throughout this World Series. But where's your head at heading into it? What would you like to see? What do you expect to see?
I mean, I'm a baseball lover. I really, really can't wait for the World Series. I love the World Series every year. I just think it's the best. Like, playoff baseball is so good, and I think the World Series is a true sort of standalone great, great thing. And I think this is an interesting matchup, man. Like it's kind of the Spider-Man meme, sort of. But if one of the Spider-Man memes was really rich and one of them was really poor, that's kind of the way I look at it. They're very, very similar teams in terms of lineup flexibility, great starting pitching, hard throwers out of the bullpen, gonna do bullpen games in the World Series. Like, there's just, it's a weird sort of matchup that I think is a sort of compelling one. And I hate to dump on our boy Alex Anthopoulos and the Braves, but thank God it's not the Braves and the Rays. Oh my God, talk about boring. Like, that would be the least compelling thing. And I think, you know, there's the storylines like with the Friedman connection with the Rays and the Dodgers. And I think that's just a way more compelling storyline. And I'm excited for it, man. And like I've been talking about all night, give me those Kershaw narratives. I'm hungry for some narratives, baby. I just really can't wait to see what he looks like tomorrow night. And I mean, Tyler Glasnow, boy, oh boy, that guy is a sick pitcher to watch. His hunk per nine innings is through the roof. Great eyes, great arm, hell of a pitcher. So I'm really excited to see him work too. So I really am excited for it, I have to admit. And, you know, the fans add an element. And there's going to be fans, right, at the World Series. So I'm excited for it all around.
Yeah, well said. As am I. World Series starts up tomorrow. Clayton Kershaw will be on the mound, and I think what we know about that, one way or another, there'll be a lot to say. There was something I meant to get to a little earlier on. This is going to shock you. I'm going to bring it back to the Leafs for half a second.
Oh,
I know
yes.
this will astonish you.
I know what you're going to get to, and I want to talk
now,
to it.
Look, we've talked a lot about Kyle Dubas potentially being a changed man. We're not going to reiterate it. You think he's changed his tune. I'm not so much sure how much that's happened. There is one thing that has not changed at all in Kyle Dubas' world. And there's one player. He just, you know, we all have those people in our lives. It's like maybe they'll let you down a little bit from time to time. You know, maybe you expect them to pick you up and they're a little bit late. Or, you know, maybe they're your golf partner and they're always showing up late to foursomes. But you can't quit them. And with that guy, for Kyle Dubas, it's Cody Ceci. Now, he was asked about him. I do want to be clear about this. He did not just go out of his way to say this, but at the last avail we saw from him, I believe Cody Ceci, who's now signed with the Penguins, Dubas was asked about that. I thought he played well for us, and I know people don't like to hear it. Kyle, if you know it, don't say it. For a team that does so much media training, like, honestly, think about it. Like, think about how much some of these younger guys have started to be a little more comfortable around the media. Matthews is a different guy than he was a few years ago. We know the Leafs have this media department. You would think the answer would be, just don't talk about Cody Ceci. Just don't talk about him. No good can come. Now, I know the thought here is, oh, if I show to other free agents that if you're maligned, I'll have your back. Look, you do that with other guys. You want to defend Mitch Marner. I didn't love it. I got it. Maybe Cody Ceci needs to be the piece of red meat for this fan base. Just leave him alone, Kyle. Please, leave him alone.
Yeah, like, the dreams. You know what he could have said when he's asked about him? I'm not going to comment on a player who's on another team now. We wish Cody the best. Done. And it's like, every time he's asked about Cody, oh, you know, we have these internal metrics. Cody, you know, Cody's not that bad, guys. Cody, you know, he can take a wrister from the top of the circle and hit the other team's bench, but he's not that bad. I love Cody. Cody, you know, he's not the best skater, but you guys just don't understand Cody. It sounds like a high school, you know, maybe like your high school girlfriend trying to defend like Sam McKee to their parents. Yeah. Like, oh, you just don't know. You just don't understand Sam. He's actually so smart and he's actually so handsome. You just don't understand. It's like, that's what I picture when I picture Kyle defending Cody Ceci.
I picture the exact same thing. I also one day picture somebody in the Leafs ID department going, oh man, we had the charts mislabeled. Morgan Rielly was Cody Ceci the whole time. And they're just like, they just kept waiting for it. They're like, I see all these metrics. It's incredible. And you kind of hinted at it there. I don't know that there was a funnier, not at the time, believe me, not at the time. In hindsight, I don't know if there was a funnier moment in the Leafs season than Cody Ceci missing the net by 77 feet wide.
Right? Honestly, he dumped it in from the top of the circle. He did a dump in. He's brutal. I mean, and yeah, the Penguins. Can we just, like, what are they doing? The Penguins, honestly, like, wild. They get rid of Gabranson, get Jack Johnson. They get rid of Jack Johnson, they get Cody Ceci. Like, does Jim Rutherford have his fascination with just terrible defensemen? That's so weird. Such a weird fit. I don't know. Here's the thing. Cody Ceci on that contract playing bottom pair minutes is a different scenario than Cody Ceci playing top pair minutes at $4.5 million. I think we can all agree on that. But Cody Ceci doesn't make your hockey team better. He's a punt. He is a human punt. So I think he'll be punting at lots on the Penguins next year. Him and Kasperi reunited. I'm sure they're best of friends. So we'll see how that goes.
Could you imagine Kapanen and the boys are like, oh, you played with them. What's it like? It's like, you better be good at knocking down outlet passes. Let me tell you, practice the lacrosse skills, boys.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, if you're standing in front of the net, protect your jaw because he's just going to fire it straight at your head. He's a classic butcher. Guy in my beer league team named Brent. You go to the front of the net and he shoot it from the point. Cover your extremities, boys, because you don't know where it's going.
Yeah, hey, at least when Phaneuf was doing that, there was a little more positive to come from that. Oh, also, Cody Ceci, we should have known this was a problem when he started wearing 83. Look, tough number for anybody. Last thing before we step aside and our producer, Shoal Lee, joins us. That's the only thing giving me even the slightest bit of pause on TJ Brody. I'm like, yo, do you want to do over on 78? We're sure that's the jersey number you want to go with?
Has anyone asked him about that?
Like, I haven't seen it asked. I mean, it's a weird number.
How many players in the history of the NHL have worn 78? Like, I feel like that's like the first time I've ever seen it. Like, honestly, like,
yeah, yeah, no, maybe it's, like, not, it's not a common number by any means.
I was gonna say it feels like a number that Gunnar Wolf Fontaine would have worn at the the rookie camp. Like, it's such a weird number. But anyways, I digress. I just think that there's like, what about 77? Is that one available? Like, one number down, way better? I don't know.
Or go two up and be Nick Antropov if you must wear some weird number,
would
I
love
guess.
That.
But
boy,
yeah.
Eric Prime, our boy, would love that.
Yes, he would. And hey, even if you go one down, you could have been the old Pavel Kubina. I had no problems with him in his tenure here. Yeah, I did. Let's be honest. Yeah, I definitely did. But hey, bomb from the point. We know that much for sure. What we know. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that he changed numbers, too, halfway through. Didn't he go from 78 to 31?
Yeah, that is right. I do remember that. If we're going to talk Leafs jersey numbers, allow me to get my joke in that Joe Thornton is just keeping that 97 warm for Connor McDavid in Edmonton. Just keeping
Best
it warm.
Best 97 in the Canadian division, bud.
Oh, yeah. And, we have to mention it as well. John Tavares keeping that salary cap slot warm. Both of these things are working out just lovely in Leafland. And I know everyone outside of it loves to hear that. That's why I love to twist the knife just a little bit here on Sportsnet tonight. Somebody who's going to join us next, he's put the program together. It's our producer, Shoal Lee. He's going to join us for a little bit of Best in Show. Couple segments left here on Sportsnet tonight. Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me.
Okay, Gunner, do over our Zoom chat here. I was trying to say that I wanted to say something before we got to our Best in Show segment, but I had no idea how to explain that, and so now we just get this. But I got on an incredible website, Hockey References, truly. It's just, you can figure out anything. So I looked at their sweater number thing. They have that on there. And I looked up the number 78. And 16 players have worn number 78 at some point throughout the history of the NHL. And the best player amongst them, RIP, Pavel Dimitra, would probably be the best player. Corey Tropp, Eric Landry, Byron Fraze, Andrew Walker's boy. Not exactly a murderer's row of players there, but there you go. 16 players in the history of the NHL have worn it.
Yeah, for those of you wondering what happened at the start there, me and Sam McKee have a little video chat up while we do the show, and it looked like if you've ever flown in from an international or domestic flight, for that matter, and there's the guys on the runway who are, like, doing the hands thing or with the cones, like, back it in this way, it's like that, but if the guy was getting stung by 30,000 bees. There were a lot of hands waving. It was a lot of, come to me, and I didn't know what happened. I was a little scared. We all got through it now. Here we are.
And a guy, you know, wars number 78 last year, some guy named Philippe Chalapic, who plays for the Ottawa Senators, not aware of him. So there you go. He played for the Senators, though, and he wears number 78. So there you go.
You know, I love a good Sens dunk. Yes, Philippe Chalapic, I believe, is the way that name is pronounced. And I only know that because of doing the updates for our lovely sister station, 1310 News in Ottawa. Enough about me. Enough about you. Let me bring in producer extraordinaire Sho Ali for Best in Show. Sho, how you doing tonight?
Good, boys. Good. How are you? How are you doing?
Not bad.
Doing well. Doing well. Fired up for the World Series. Joe Thornton's a Leaf. Tom Brady good. Patriots bad. Lots going on.
It's true. You know what? I've been sitting here listening to you guys with one ear, and then my other ear is tied to this Cardinals-Cowboys game. And I've become, like our friend J.D. Bunkus, I've become a degenerate gambler. But luckily, my bets hit tonight, so that's always good.
Attaboy.
What were your bets? Don't go bragging without giving us the receipts. What'd you have?
Well, let's see. I picked Clyde Edwards-Helaire on the over on the rush yards for good old Clyde for the Chiefs game. The Chiefs to win, and I also picked, Buffalo, and I also picked the over on Kyler Murray rushing yards, and he is just tormenting Dallas right now, unfortunately.
Wow. There we go.
Yeah, as soon as you said that, I'm like, I feel like you got that over about 4 seconds into this game, because time I glance up at my television screen, I forgot who had the tweet. It's so true. He looks like a toddler who is not ready for bedtime or is not ready for recess to end when he's scrambling up the field. Everyone's way bigger than him, but he's so much faster and so small. It's exactly what it looks like, and I love it. With that, we will now get into Best in Show. So what do you got for us tonight?
All right, you know what? I saw, I guess this is kind of related to Cards Cowboys. Mark Sessler, who, of course, has been on the station before. He writes for NFL.com around the NFL podcast. He tweeted this out and got me thinking, I guess if we expanded this from just football to all sports, I figured I'd ask you guys, because I feel like I heard some of this from listeners and on the text line and so on before, but either way, the question was, would you watch your favorite sports team daily or weekly in football's case, if the sports gods informed you, they came down from sports heaven, they told you boys that your team would miss the playoffs for the next 10 years. Nothing you can do about it. There's nothing the team can do about it. The Leafs, let's say for you guys, are for sure in this scenario missing the playoffs for the next 10 years. Well, how would that affect your enjoyment, let's say?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. And at first blush, I would say there's no way I would watch, right? That's the first sort of inclination. But at the same time, you mentioned how you're a degenerate gambler now. I'm just a degenerate sports fan who watches sports. That's like I build my life around watching sports, you know. 7 p.m. comes on a weeknight and the Leafs are playing and I'm watching the sport. So I feel like even with the knowledge and my dumbo brain, hey, look, when the Leafs tanked, what year was that, 15, 16? I watched every
game. We knew.
I watch every game. I watched every single game of that season. So I think I would probably watch, even though as dumb as that is, I think I would, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I'm right there in the same boat. I would probably try to, like, game the system. I would find this, like, benevolent power who's giving me this deal, and I'd be like, could it be rolling 10-year period so all of my teams don't have to stink for a decade,
yes,
and it's just, like, one per decade? So it's like, okay, we get through the decade of Leafs gruel, and then it's on to Raptors gruel right after that. Like, I think that's the way you got to do it. If I was able to cut a deal, now I don't know what the negotiations are. If it's a benevolent being, I'm pretty wary some of negotiating with them, but I feel like that's the only way you could do it. But I'm right there with McKee. Like, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. So also, I watched golf in the throes of Tiger, and we basically knew he was going to win every week. So I guess a positive outcome, but not knowing isn't a reason not to watch. So I think I'd have to watch, because, yeah, what else are you going to do?
I guess that's true, right? You're pretty much married to married to your team, I think. Whatever team that may be, whatever sport that may be. I think I'm in the same boat as you guys, for what it's worth. You know, I also saw today that, and if you guys recall, I want to say, I'm not sure when this was. Maybe it was last summer. I think it was Sportsnet.ca did the, here, 40 seasons of Blue Jays baseball. How do you rank the team's 40 greatest players? And today, coincidentally, is Jose Bautista's 40th birthday. Happy birthday to Jose Bautista. And, of course, we all know the bat flip and what Jose has done for the franchise during his time with the team. Where for you guys does Jose fall on your all-time Jays list? Is he in the top five? Is he in that 6 to 10 range? Is he outside of that? Like, where is he for you guys?
Okay, so this got me thinking, all right? And this isn't going to answer your question, but it just sort of got me off on a little tangent here. And, you know, there was all that celebration about the five-year anniversary of the bat flip, and everybody's, you know, we're doing the whole thing about how amazing that team was again. It's just, you know, every year, the further we get away from it, that team didn't win anything. You know, that team, they won. That was a great team. That great game, they beat the Texas Rangers, who they were supposed to beat. You know, they were down 2-0. I love that team so much. I really do. But the further I get away from it, the less special that run feels. And I know that's really sacrilegious to say on Toronto Sports Radio, but I have to be honest with the audience. I feel less connected to it. I really do. But Jose Bautista, for that moment, I think he had a 50 home run season. He had some monster years. I think he's a really he's an all time Blue Jay. But you know, I don't know. I don't know if I put him up there with Roy Halladay. I don't know if you put him up there with the early 90s guys. But yeah, I love Jose Bautista. But if he was on any other team, he would have been my least favorite player in the league.
Well said. I think he's firmly a top five Jay. I think that, you know, for this generation of fans, obviously, you know, those 92, 93 teams will always be special for a different subset of people. I don't think you can. Nobody's passing Alomar, I don't think. Nobody's passing Doc, I don't think. Like, that's kind of like, pick your guy, that's one, that's two. But then, honestly, after that, I really do think you can start to make the case for Bautista, both in terms of the short production and in terms of what he kind of meant to this team. Because he was kind of the one guy that really kind of, he was the light in the turning of this franchise. Other guys came and they were just as big a part of those great teams. But I really do honestly think you can make a case for him as high as three. I don't know if you quite put him above Steve, but I feel like he's firmly top five.
All right, let me just for the sake of argument, let me read you guys in order what the consensus, the user-generated consensus ranking is. This is, again, from Sportsnet.ca. So the user-generated, people who subscribe and read to on SN.ca, it goes Alomar, Halladay, Steeb, Carlos Delgado is at 4, Tony Fernandez at 5, and then Jose slots in at 6, just above George Bell, Joe Carter, Tom Henke, and John Olerud for the 7, 8, 9, 10 slots.
Bautista should be above Delgado. But for me, Bautista should be above Delgado. I know track record and what that guy meant. And look, I was at all those games. I watched him go yard. Him and Sean Green, loved those teams. But in terms of the heights actually reached kind of by the Bautista Jays, I think you got to push him ahead for that. And then the fact that the bat flip, I know at the grand scheme of things, didn't end up meaning anything. But that is an iconic sports moment in this city that will live forever. And I think that has to count for something.
You know, do you guys think that this just came to my mind, but considering, Sam, where you are on the whole, you know, you feel a little more disconnected as time goes on, and the bat flip, like, in a singular moment is certainly exceptional and fantastic, but it's not like that team went on to win the World Series or even make the World Series, for that matter. And in the same kind of vein, people were kind of talking about, and I know you, Sam, were on, I wanted to say you were on the radio with Russick, I think, the next day after the Leafs had the ridiculous comeback against the Blue Jackets to avoid elimination in that particular game, at least early a couple of months ago. Does that kind of fall into the same vein as like fantastic sports moments in a flashpoint, but because it didn't go anywhere, you kind of forget about it after a while?
Well, here's what I'll say about comparing those two things. I think that it's pretty obvious that the 2015, 2016 Jays were much more meaningful than that. Like, I mean, that was, sure, they got a fluky comeback win in an otherwise dud series. That that 2015 Jays series is much more meaningful than that. But I think there's some sort of comparison to them. And I think even George Russick talked about that on that day in terms of comparing those two. And if the Leafs had to come back and beat Columbus on that Sunday night, maybe we could compare it if the Leafs had to gone on a long run. But I don't know. That bubble loss to the Blue Jackets is just that left such a bad taste in my mouth. I don't even like thinking about it. But yeah, I shouldn't say that. Like, I was at a couple of those games. I was downtown Toronto after the bat flip. It was a special time in the city, you know, but the way that that team's talked about it, like they won the World Series, you know, they didn't even make the World Series in either year. So I think people just romanticize that team a lot because it's just been such a long time since, you know, the Jays were in the playoffs even. But look at the Dodgers. They go to the World Series every year, you know, they haven't won, but like they've had a sustained success. I don't know. I know it's a soapbox argument. I know no one's really arguing against me, but it's just kind of how I feel about those teams after the years have gone by.
Well, and let me jump in on the Leafs' point of that. If in 3 or 4 years we're talking about that comeback against Columbus, that's a massive problem. That game should be washed away from the sands of time, and it's like a funny thing, almost like we think of that the good Leafs Carolina 8-6 game from the Young Guns game. It should just be a fun thing we think about as part of this team's road to actual success. But if we're sitting here in 3 years going, oh man, remember that comeback, and then they forced a game 5 and lost in a playoff series that wasn't even a playoff series, that is a criminal indictment of this Leafs core. So I hope we don't even really think about that in a couple of years.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, fair. I just wanted to know where you guys stood on that. It just came to mind kind of out of the blue. My next got one for you guys. You kind of were talking about the Canadian division and the NHL, just to go back to to hockey here. The potential for it, certainly nothing has been confirmed. But I had seen David Amber, our co-host here on Hockey Central, David Amber. He had tweeted, if such a thing existed, what four teams would make the playoffs? So if for you guys, what four teams of only Canadian teams, what four teams are making the playoffs if such a thing happens?
I'll jump in here. Easy peasy. The Sens are out, I could tell you that much. Leafs are in, the Oilers are in, the Flames are in, and the Jets are in. I think the Canucks just lost too much this offseason. I think Demko is going to cover off for Markstrom just fine, but I think in terms of the rest of their depth, obviously Nate Schmidt helps with that. I think they'll probably be just on the outside looking in. Montreal kind of slotting behind them. And then I think, look, I dump on the Sens as much as anyone. This is supposed to be the fun part for them. It's all gravy. You lose a game, it's great. You'll get a better pick. The kids look good. That's good too, but they'll be the worst Canadian team this year. So yeah, that'd be my answer.
I go Leafs, Habs, Canucks, Flames.
Ooh, no Oilers.
That's who I go. Because I don't, no. Oilers, buddy, they got Mike Smith in net, and they got, like, they didn't really improve their decor. So like I you know, the Oilers have scored 100 goals a game and get scored on a bunch. So give me no Oilers again. You know what? It's just me vicariously hoping that Connor McDavid gets sadder and sadder and eventually demands his way out of there and comes to Toronto. So basically that's what I'm getting at here.
Fair. Look, I heard you guys banging the drums for that all night. That, I love it. I love it.
Could you imagine the hockey world the day that gets out? Like, we all know it wouldn't actually be a demand from McDavid, but can you imagine the Friedman tweet or something along the lines of hearing rumblings, kind of like the stuff we've heard about Line A or like we've heard about Eichel? You want to talk about like an aftershock through the hockey world? That'd be incredible. Every market in the league would be, what would you give up for McDavid? What's a fair package? Like, you want to talk about a shot in the arm? We're going to need that one of these off seasons. So, yeah. I'm right there with you, McKee. Please, Oilers, please continue to be in this mushy middle that I'm sure is oh so frustrating to 97.
I got a couple more for you guys here. You know what? I'm not sure if you had seen this. Here's two more here for you. I'm not sure if you had seen this, guys, but they released the the, I guess, the plot description, let's say, for Space Jam 2. Okay, and I don't know if you've seen it, but I'm just going to read it for you, for anyone who hasn't heard it. So Space Jam, during a trip to the Warner Brothers studio, NBA superstar LeBron James and his son accidentally get trapped within a world that contains all of Warner Brothers' stories and characters under the control of a malfunctioning, all-powerful force named Al G. With the help of Bugs, LeBron must navigate through a never-before-imagined world filled with iconic movie scenes and characters. As they reassemble the Looney Tunes to rescue his son, to get back home, LeBron and the Toons have to unravel the plan and win a basketball game against digital, gamified super versions of the NBA and WNBA's biggest stars as the entire world watches. Now, it says a world that contains all of Warner Brothers' stories. Like, are we going to see like Pennywise and the Joker and so on against LeBron here or what?
I don't even know who's Warner Brothers, who's DC, who's Marvel. I don't know about any of that. But my first reaction to this when I read this description was the famous Stephen A. Smith clip, "Stay off the weed." Like, whoever came up with that, it's like, maybe dial it down just a hair. It's like, what's wrong with there's a new set of Monstars? Like, it feels like we're just going way too complicated there. I tweeted it out on Twitter. I just put the Cody Bellinger face because that's exactly how I felt reading that. It's too much. It's too confusing. Just let LeBron battle the Monstars. Why are we overcomplicating this? I can't believe I'm this passionate about Space Jam 2.
Yeah, this is so stupid. That's the stupidest plot to a stupid movie that's going to suck. How's that for a take?
I'm not surprised. I'm not shocked whatsoever, Sam.
Hey, guess what? I haven't been to the theater in 2 years. Won't be going for that one either because it sounds terrible.
Oh, man. I look forward to having both of you on my movie podcast after Space Jam 2 comes out. And we all break quarantine to go see it just for... No, we're not doing that. We'll end on this one. Of course, Tim and Sid were talking about this, and it was kind of news in the hockey world. Of course, Mike Doc Emrick retired today. He announced his retirement. Happy retirement to Doc. 74 years old, hundreds of games, I should say, announced. And... Doc had kind of gained, I guess, notoriety, obviously for being a very good broadcaster, but also for basically being the man who had like 100 or 200 nouns and verbs to describe a pass, essentially, right? And I was on social media today, and I found this really fun remix. Now, I figure we could play the first, let's say, 30 seconds of this remix made entirely of Doc Emrick words. It's a kind of a parody of a Daft Punk song. So we'll see if, Tom, if you could play that. We'll see if these guys are familiar with it.
Mash it, rip it, stop it, walk it, guide it, let it, seal, soccer it, brings it, flings it, walks it, works it, guides it, slides it, tip, trickles it, lays it, plays it, sees it, sends it, banks it, boards it, punch, hustles it, drags it, drops it, gives it, lops it, feeds it, leads it, dodge it, rattle it, finesses it, finesses it, finesses it, finesses it, gets it, lets it, sends it, flips it, fires it.
All right, we'll fade it down now. I think CanCon rules, that's enough. We'll fade that down. Look, here's the thing. Doc Emrick, he brought hockey to America. I cannot knock him for that. But I'm never going to, talk ill of a guy while he's retiring. Good on him. Great career. But please, I like my Canadian guys calling hockey. I'm sorry if that's a dumb nationalistic take. He did a great job. And everything he did to grow the game in the States is great. And we should commend him for all that. But I've seen a lot of people in this country talking about how great he is when we've got a lot of talent up here as well. So good on Doc. Call games on the States on NBC for years and years and years. Good on you. Good career. And enjoy retirement. I think I speak for Sam McKee in that.
I do, but I do like the way he said it. Ska! Is that a good impression?
I think
it's a little Romanesque of you.
Yeah, a little. I was going to say, yeah, a little bit. I only wanted to bring it up because he says waffle boarding, and I don't know if there's a bigger, better verb than
see, that's too much. No, that's too much. Like, you don't need to say that. Like, that's just like, I don't know. Like, I'm not gonna crap on the guy or anything, but you don't need to say waffle boarding in a hockey game. That's just my opinion. That's just one of a man's humble opinion.
The only thing in sports that needs that many names for it is homers in baseball. I've never heard one for a bomb, a deep shot, a big fly, a tappy, whatever you want to call it.
Dinger.
I've never heard a bad one. A dinger. And you know who's never said a bad one? Kevin Barker. Keep listening to him on Baseball Central all throughout the World Series. You'll be able to hear it on Sportsnet. or watch it on Sportsnet. Hear it right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Show, anything else before we let you go?
No, gentlemen. I am about to go collect my winnings from Cardinals Cowboys. I'm very excited. Thank you so much.
Attaboy, show.
All right, there we go. Love hearing about other people's gambling. We know that. Now, there was one thing we didn't get into tonight. A little bit of time left. Going to wrap up the show. It's a Raptors-related topic. What's that? Well, we'll tell you. It has to do with the salary cap and Giannis. One segment left on Sportsnet tonight. Final segment here of Sportsnet tonight. Brent Gunning, Sam McKee alongside me. Want to thank everyone who helped put the show together. Tom Young on the boards, and you just heard him on the last segment there. Producer Sho Ali. We're going to talk a little Raptors in just a second, but a Canadian can't have a good weekend in the world of sports and not have me talk about it. It was Canadian hero Mike Weir. Yes, we're going to talk a little very hot, very, very brief Champions Tour golf.
Oh, yeah.
Mike Weir battling down the stretch with Phil Mickelson. This is very on brand for us that we watched a lot of that on an NFL Sunday. It helps when there's only 2 4 o'clock games. Lefty just pulling out ahead of Mike Weir. But Mike Weir now on the Champions Tour, nearly got the win this weekend. I know you were happy to see Weirzy out there again.
Yeah, I got to say that's just exactly right. He looked great, you know, like Weirzy. He looks like he's in awesome shape. Played great this weekend. He's playing against Cheater Phil, who's going down there, you know, just making everybody feel bad. You know, oh, look at me. Everybody, look at me. You know, I can go and I'm still relevant. You know, I'm playing on the Champions Tour. Ha ha. Making a mockery of everyone down here. Ha ha ha. Anyways. But yeah, good for Weirzy. I love Weirzy. And he looked awesome and he played great. And he won. He actually won. But the guy who's hitting 337 yards on the Champions Tour won the tournament. What a surprise. What a loser Phil is, honestly.
Yeah, we've talked about it before. I've done a 180, or I guess a 360. I'm back to where I started. I had a brief detour where I got sucked in by the dark arts of his Instagram and his coffee love, but now I'm all the way back to hating Phil, just like I know you are. Quick little couple golf notes. Tiger returning this week, the Zozo Championship.
Let's go.
He's still the technical defending champ, I believe, from that tournament. And then in 23 days, another tournament begins that he is most certainly the defending champ of. And that's the Masters. Yes, we're just 23 short days away from a sweet, sweet November Masters. I know you're excited, McKee. We will talk about it plenty before then. But I did want to bring this up before we get out of here tonight. Fred VanVleet, obviously he's a free agent, probably the biggest question mark piece of business for the Raptors this year. Tim Bontemps with a bit of a report basically saying that the Raptors hope to keep him to 4 years, $80 million or $20 million a season. If they're able to do that, that would still allow them to be in the market for Giannis for when he hits the market in a couple of years' time. Do you think that's a possibility? And how important is it? Should the Raptors potentially ruin a shot at Giannis if it means bringing back VanVleet?
Well, no, they shouldn't. But I don't know how real a shot they have at Giannis. And I don't know if you want to risk that. I mean, like losing him and then not getting Giannis too. It's a tough pill to swallow. But boy, oh boy, I wouldn't want to go much higher than $80 million for Fred VanVleet. I'll tell you that right now. I don't know how you feel about it, but like, I love Fred, and Fred has a ton of emotional equity with me and with this whole market for his performance against the Bucks and for his performance in the finals against the Golden State Warriors. But that's a lot of money. That's a lot of cake, and that's something you got to be really sure about. And I'm sure that he would take that contract in Toronto. You know, the development, the patience they had with him, the willingness to sign him being undrafted. But man, you better be sure if you're dropping $80 million on Fred VanVleet. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, I think it really all depends on what you think of Pascal and OG. If you think those guys are good enough to be a one and a three, and you think Fred VanVleet can be your two, then I think you've gotta lock them up, because if you feel like you have kind of three guys that can compete, I feel like you have to do that. And really, that's a question the Raptors have to ask themselves. And you know, the thing I can see a world where Kyle Lowry's gone and it's Fred VanVleet's team. And you know, I don't know how good that team is, and so much of that comes back to Pascal Siakam. And you know, we don't have time to rehash it all here, but I think that's where so much of the question marks lie with this Raptors team, is just what exactly do you have in that guy? If he's a perennial all-star, if he's somebody who can be your kind of lead dog or second banana, then I think you really have to kind of commit to continue to keep this thing going, almost Dodgers-esque. But if you have real doubts about what Pascal Siakam is, then I think that's when you have to start looking at, okay, how expensive should this core be, and how important is it to keep it all together?
Yeah, and that's why the Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster, and they make the big bucks to make these kind of decisions. But I'm not going to lie to you, I would love a Masai Ujiri contract at some point here. Because boy, oh boy, that's looming. That's in a big way.
Yeah, I think if you gave any of us the choice, it's like Fred walks, but Masai stays. Sorry, Fred. We'll always remember the screaming in Golden State and the birth of Fred Jr. But yeah, I think it's a very easy choice to make. And yeah, that's you know, we talk about Siakam, but that's the true question mark hanging over the Raptors. And I think a lot of people are very much questioning exactly what that means. And you know, the thing is we can sit here and we can speculate, but we don't have any clue, because you know, I would imagine MLSE has made every attempt to lock him up at pretty much any price, but it's been such radio silence. We really haven't heard much there. One thing we will hear from tomorrow, that's the start of the World Series. I know we're both fired up. Clayton Kershaw on the mound. No matter what happens, there will be plenty of talking points coming out of it. Also, quickly, before we step aside, Supporter Shield, what is it? Did it happen in MLS? They're getting into it and kicking the grass. Do you know it's a thing, Sam McKee?
The Supporter Shield is the trophy. It's the shield for the best, the most points in the regular season. And I think they're getting rid of it for some reason, but I don't know why. And I love it. I love TFC, and I've watched pretty much every TFC game, even in this pandemic season, and I don't really know why they're getting rid of it. But quickly, before we go, prediction, World Series. Let me have it.
Dodgers in six. I think it'll be a pretty comfortable, but Dodgers in six. What do you got?
Dodgers in seven. And Clayton Kershaw gives up four runs in the first two innings in Game 7, and the Dodgers overcome it.
Oh, baby. Let's go. You'll be able to watch all the drama on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 1, Sportsnet Now, really. It'll be all over. You'll also be able to listen to the games here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'll be back on Wednesday night with Rob Wong talking around Game 2. I'm sure you'll be back probably for your Saturday mornings with Wonger as well. I want to thank everyone who joined us to help make the show oh so special tonight. Thoroughly enjoyed my talk with Ryan Dixon, mostly just because he agreed with me about Canadian Thanksgiving and the NHL. Please enjoy Kick in the Grass. That's up next here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.